Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
We are back with Fight Night Picks, the picks and predictions, and we're really looking forward to a great card coming up this weekend. You now have Jack Hermanson not taking on Kevin Holland, but Marvin Vettori in the main event at middleweight. And Matt, this is a really good card. I mean, last week we both had the opportunity to kind of take some time away, spend some time on some special projects. We had the preview of Tyson and Jones Jr. We've also had a chance to try and revamp This Week in MMA. It's going to be coming out later on this week, so make sure you keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, because we always do say that. But we do appreciate everybody for sticking around, tossing the like, tossing the subs, and it has been a wild ride. So, Matt, overall, we're really looking forward to a good card coming up this weekend. There's a lot of really under-the-radar fights. There's a lot of things that we're certainly looking forward to, Matt. And I mean, hey, in the States, you folks just had Thanksgiving last week. Well, we're really giving thanks to a great card coming up this weekend from the Apex facility in Vegas. The UFC continuing to put on some really good fights. And Matt, it does suck that we're missing out on a main event between Marvin Vettori, or rather Kevin Holland and Jack Hermanson. In steps Marvin Vettori. I really think that this fight stylistically is a really good fight.
It really is. Trades never happen in MMA. I mean, other than Ben Askren and Demetrius Johnson. But Jack Hermanson and Jacare basically just traded their opponents. So now we got Vettori Hermanson and Holland Jacare. And honestly, I kind of like both the matchups better, because Kevin Holland matches up a lot better with Jacare, and Marvin Vettori actually matches up better with Jack Hermanson. So if you're kind of cheering for maybe not the new blood in the division, because I know Jack Hermanson, he hasn't really been an established name at the top of the division for years now, it's a really exciting time in middleweight. Because if Kevin Holland can pull off, I'll say the upset over Jacare, and same thing with Marvin Vettori, the division's going to look so much different and really only 1 week's time. So I'm really excited with both the new matchups. And I got to be honest, I think a little bit higher of Marvin Vettori. Marvin Vettori deserves this opportunity a little bit more than Kevin Holland. He's been in the top 15 for a little while. He has been promised multiple high, or at least sort of big named opponents. He was supposed to get one, of course, in Jacare. But a win over Jack Hermanson is a lot better than a win over Jacare at this stage in his career. So Marvin Vettori has got to be thrilled about this new opportunity.
100%. I mean, in a main event opportunity or setting, it's really a good one. And we saw what Jack Hermanson did in his last fight against Kelvin Gastelum. Marvin Vettori just on an absolute ride. I mean, hey, losing Israel Adesanya, at least not fully completely. I mean, it was a relatively competitive fight. And since then, Marvin Vettori has looked very good. So we're really looking forward to that fight. Obviously, don't have a fight poster over there yet, because this fight only really happened to take shape over the last 24 hours. But we do have for you a couple of great Fight of the Night selections already, Matt. Gabriel Mowgli Benitez taking on Justin the Guitar Hero Janes. I'm really looking forward to this fight. It's actually taking place at lightweight. I know a lot of people probably figured, well, Benitez, he's more or less a featherweight, and so is Justin Janes. But Janes revealed to friend of the show and fellow Canadian James Lynch that the fight will be at lightweight. The UFC's website has it at lightweight. And for Benitez, another fight at lightweight. His last one, a relative short notice call-up to take on Omar Morales. Why do you have this circled as a possible fight of the night?
Because the way that Justin Janes fights, he's very good at just brawling. And I know he's only had two fights in the UFC so far, and he has 1-1. But just look at both those fights. So he goes out, knocks out Frank Camacho in just an absolute, really smoke show of a punch. Puts Frank Camacho out, a guy who's been known to be in those kind of crazy wars and a guy who can absorb a lot of punishment, knocks him out in the first minute of their fight. And then he comes out against Gavin Tucker, who is just a really well-rounded mixed martial artist. I know, you know, we talk about him quite a bit because he is kind of from our end of the country, but they put on an absolute show. Justin Janes is able to drop Gavin Tucker, really had him in trouble on the feet at multiple different times during the fight. And Gabriel Benitez, he's just kind of been one of those guys at 145 where he might not always get the big name opponents. He might not always get, you know, the prime time spots in the card, but he is always going to give you a great show. And yes, he has losses to guys like Sadiq Youssef. Yes, he lost Omar Morales, but you know what you're going to get from Gabriel Benitez. You're going to get phenomenal Muay Thai. His kicks are insane. He does have a very similar game to a Luke Rockhold where he will just throw kicks. You can block each and every one of them if you want to, but he knows your arm's going to hurt worse than his leg and your leg's going to hurt worse than his. And he will kind of throw them with reckless abandon. And if the fight goes to the mat, Gabriel Benitez, a really good example of a striker with great defensive submissions, where if he is getting the better of you on the feet and you do shoot for a takedown, if you leave your neck out there, he will clamp a hold of it. So both guys can fight at every range, and if this is just a strict kickboxing fight on the feet, we saw what Gabriel Benitez is able to do against a guy like Sadiq Youssef, who I think is sort of a more improved Justin James or a more down his path Justin James. So if Benitez can have a competitive fight with Youssef, I think he should be able to put on a show against Justin James.
And Matt, we gotta say it now, competitive until he got finished
he
in
did,
that fight.
But at least he was able to put on a much better showing than most people are against Sadiq Youssef. He dropped him. He had him in a lot of trouble. And Justin James will throw similar strikes to a Youssef. He's not going to, you know, go up, work behind the jab, just throw straight punches. He will throw some of those looping shots. So Benitez can stick down the middle and just keep on firing his straight left. I think he'll have good results.
Now, I mean, Matt, I am really looking forward to this one. And you can boil it down in a lot of different ways. But you have Gabriel Benitez, who came in off of The Ultimate Fighter, Latin America Season 1, won it. You have Justin James coming in, a coach at Extreme Couture. And again, 2-0 so far, or sorry, 1-1 so far in his two fights in the UFC is Justin James, coming off that loss to Gavin Tucker earlier on this summer, the win back in June over Frank Camacho. For Gabriel Benitez, yes, he's on a two-fight losing streak. The last time he was on a two-fight losing streak was just before he got that shot on The Ultimate Fighter Season 1 Latin America. So Gabriel Benitez looking to get things going again. Justin James looking to avoid a two-fight skid. Overall, this should be a very good fight. Now, Matt, my pick was Scramble City. Nate Landwehr taking on Movsar Evloev. And Matt, I'm really looking forward to this one because, again, we talk about it. We always used to focus more so on the world of mixed martial arts. The ONE Championships, the Bellators, the M1 Globals, where these two came from. And back when I was really watching every single M1 Global show on Fridays, whenever they were coming out Saturday morning here in North America, I remember where I was parked on the couch watching M1 Challenge 95, Battle of the Mountains number 7, when Movsar Evloev defended, or rather challenged for his belt, and Nate Landwehr fighting for the featherweight belt. Now, for Evloev, he was at 135 pounds, Landwehr at 145 pounds, both very competitive fights, both gamers. Movsar Evloev, master of sport in Greco-Roman wrestling. You've seen that so far in his UFC fights. 3-0, all three by decision. Really weird scoring, and we'll get into that when we get into our full fight previews during this full card preview. For Nate Landwehr, 1-1 so far in the UFC. And it's weird because if you look at the line for this fight, it makes absolutely no sense. Movsar Evloev is an average of more than a 5-1 favorite on best fight odds. For Nate Landwehr in his last fight, to steal a line from this past week just because it's current with Tyson Jones Jr., y'all must have forgot, Nate Landwehr beat Darren Elkins in his last fight, and he looked good in that one.
And I think it's really important to say how he beat Darren Elkins, too. He beat Darren Elkins in a very Darren Elkins fight. He matched the volume, and he just made it an ugly battle between those two, and it was a phenomenal fight. And I do like how you preface this. This is a scramble-based fight if there ever was one. Evloev does use his wrestling kind of similar to a Pyotr Yan, where he's not going to be going for a ton of takedowns. It's just if you go for a takedown on him, you might be able to get it. His back might touch the ground, but he has springs on his shoulders. He just bounces right back up to the feet, and his scrambles are phenomenal. He's not going to use them as much to get on top as much as he will just get back up to his feet and get back to his great work. And Nate Landwehr, his fights are always exciting because of the pressure that he brings. Like I said, he does fight in a bit of a Darren Elkins manner. It's easy to make the comparison, of course, because it was his last opponent, but he will just go forward. He's not really afraid of eating shots. He will eat two shots to give one, and that does get him in trouble because, of course, he's not the most powerful striker out there, so if he is on the negative side of the striking differential, you got to get a little worried, but like you had said, for the odds, this doesn't make any sense. This is very much a fight-of-the-night style fight, and for it to be a fight of the night, it has to be competitive, and I do see this being an absolute barn burner.
I see it being, again, way more competitive than those odds would suggest. I mean, at 5-1, you think Movsar Evloev is going to absolutely walk all over Nate Landwehr. He has lost rounds so far in the UFC, Movsar Evloev, and Nate Landwehr is the perfect type of opponent. He'll brawl. His takedown defense, maybe not the best, but his scrambles are great, and he always makes for one half a very entertaining fight. Matt, our fight of the night today brought to you by Manscaped. You can see them there. This is the first week with the full card picks that we have Manscaped as a presenting sponsor. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. Check out the link down below in the description. That's 20% off and free shipping with manscaped.com, and use the promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. And Matt, we thank you, everybody out there at home. I mean, we're over 17,000 subscribers so far in 2020 from about 1,000 at the start of the year. And it's all thanks to everybody out there. We really do appreciate your support this week. Matt, I have paper notes again. I'm going all out as far as fight knowledge is concerned for this card because, hey, We want to pick ourselves back up. We want to have a really good week. I'm really looking forward to this card. We've got a great set of prelims. We got a really good main card too. And again, Hermanson Vettori at the top. So stick with us. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. And let's get into it. We are set for UFC Fight Night Hermanson versus Vettori. And yes, I said Marvin Vettori because Vittori's stepping in for Kevin Holland, who's now set to face Jacare Souza. And Matt, in this fight, and it's very interesting, at 135 pounds, we have Jose Alberto Quinones taking on Luis Smolka. And Matt, Fight Night Picks fans might be familiar with Matt and Craig breaking down a fight between these two guys because it was supposed to happen just a few weeks ago. And really, the big storyline going into this fight versus the fight that was supposed to materialize a few weeks ago is the fact that Luis Smolka actually weighed in at 139 pounds for that fight. And then he was taken off the card. He was deemed medically unfit. He went through bouts of dizziness and nausea. You know, he seems to think that he's going to be back at full force. And the weirdest thing about this is the fact that Luis Smolka was a guy that competed at flyweight for what seemed like the longest time. Now, I know his run in the UFC, the first run, it was good. I mean, he went 5-5. The start of it was a lot better than the end because he was on a 4-fight losing streak. But overall, really big names that he had faced. I know he was a minus 500 favorite when he fought Brandon Moreno. He lost that fight. He also had a fight that main evented a Fight Night card against Paddy Houlihan. Yes, South Dublin County Councilor Paddy Houlihan. Really weird. It was a 3-round main event, but it was what it was. And Luis Smolka got the win there as well. So for Luis Smolka, 5-5 at flyweight in his first UFC run. And then in the second run, he's been 2-2 at bantamweight. All of four of those fights finishes. Now, for good or for better or for worse, I guess. But overall, for Luis Smolka, it's been a weird run. The second run has been so-so. I mean, he had that win over Sue Muttergy that we saw just last week pick up a really big win in his own right. And the other win over Ryan McDonald, we haven't really seen a whole lot of out of Ryan McDonald. The losses, Casey Kenney was a really tough one in his last fight. And I know we're going to talk about that one because, Matt, that was that classic Luis Smolka effect. And I was going to say performance, but classic Luis Smolka effect. Can you kind of learn us? Can you kind of teach us about the Luis Smolka effect?
So basically, we have a term for fighters who fight like Luis Smolka, and Luis Smolka does one thing in every single one of his fights. Now, there's something that I've been bringing up a lot in our videos. Some fighters will give away moments in fights, and Yoel Romero is a very good example of this, and you probably didn't think I was going to bring Yoel Romero into a Luis Smolka video, but Yoel will have just these long periods in his fight of activity, and all those moments are just what I consider time that he gives to his opponent, where as long as you're doing anything, you'll be winning those points in the fight. Luis Smolka has that issue, but it's not on the feet. Actually, on the feet, he keeps a pretty good volume, he has good pressure, he is hittable, but we'll get to that in a second. On his back, for a guy who is a very good grappler in Luis Smolka, he's very good offensively, he can go and fish for a lot of different submissions, he is more than happy to just spend, I would say minutes, but you could also stretch it to just rounds off of his back with his guard closed and just kind of not doing a lot. There's sort of these weird stalling positions. And yes, if you watch a lot of MMA or if Tony Ferguson's on his back and he's throwing elbows and he's hurting you worse than you're hurting him, yes, the judges might give you that round. But if you're Luis Smolka and you're just kind of going for position on the ground, but you're never trying to attempt to sweep or you're never trying to attempt to get back up to your feet, those are issues. And those are just moments in a fight that you're giving away to your opponent. Now, Jose Quinones is going to win moments in this fight, without a doubt. The question you really have to ask yourself is, will the moments that Quinones himself will go out and win, will those tied with the fact that Luis Smolka is able to give away minutes in fights, will that just make up enough time for Quinones to get a decision win? And it's really interesting because if you look at what Quinones does, I don't think he'll be going for a lot of takedowns. It's something he has done in his UFC career. And honestly, something he doesn't really get the credit he deserves, because when you think of Jose Quinones, the striking is always the first thing that jumps out. And of course, the fight against Sean O'Malley is the first one that everyone brings up. But if you're in a primary kickboxing fight with Sean O'Malley, I don't care who you are, you're probably going to lose, especially if it's in an MMA fight. Quinones has shown the ability. He has a decent double leg. We had seen that a little bit earlier on in his career. And it's interesting. He does wrestle less at this stage than he did in his first sort of little run in the UFC. And with Luis Smolka, it's kind of odd. If Quinones had decent power, I would say Quinones all day long. Because Luis Smolka, it's not that he stands like Randy Marcos in one of those weird, awkward positions, but he does keep his hands at a very strange level, and he throws these really big looping hooks. Now, if he lands them, they do damage. But the issue is he leaves himself very open. We've seen a lot of Luis Smolka fights. The Mateus Nicolau one is a really great one to bring up because Nicolau was just able to sort of time his hooks and then land shots either over the top or through the middle of his guard. And he dropped Smolka 3 times in their fight. Now, I don't believe Jose Quiñones has that kind of pop behind his shots. Nicolau, although no longer in the UFC, at one point was one of the scarier guys in the division. So I don't know if he'll have that kind of an effect on his shots. I'm just a little worried about Smolka. If he is sort of chasing after Quiñones, and if he isn't able to get the takedown himself, Quiñones is either going to be the one on top, just sort of wasting time in Smolka's guard, or can Quiñones just sort of stay on his bike, pump out the jab, and if he needs the takedown, he can go for it.
We've seen Jose Quiñones too do a good job of circling his opponents, throwing that right hand, and I mean, they have him on certain sites listed as a southpaw. If you watch the majority of that Carlos Joaquin fight, I mean, most of it from the orthodox stance. You also watch that fight he had against Sean O'Malley. You can't really learn a whole lot from it. I mean, he gets dropped fairly early in that one, and that's all she wrote. And he was a big underdog as well. The troubling thing for me is if we have a look at Jose Quiñones, came into the UFC off of the Ultimate Fighter Latin America Season 1, and we talked about Gabriel Benitez as one of our Fight of the Nights. He was also in that season. But Jose Quiñones losing at his weight class to Alejandro Perez. So that's his first fight that's truly in the UFC. After that, we look at the wins that he has. Leonardo Morales, Joey Gomez, Diego Rivas, Taruto Ishihara, Carlos Joaquin. Well, all of those are good wins, but none of those guys are any longer in the UFC. And you look at the losses, I mean, we're talking Perez, who, yeah, okay, we haven't really seen him in a long time, but he was quite good. Nathaniel Wood and Sean O'Malley, that's pretty good competition. So to me, this is one of those litmus test type of fights for Jose Quiñones. And it's more or less the same thing for Luis Smolka too. 500 record in the UFC, both at flyweight and at bantamweight. He was definitely fighting a higher quality of opponent at flyweight than he has so far at bantamweight. But it's just been a weird run. And for Luis Smolka, you kind of talked about it. His striking, he's always busy. He'll throw a calf kick. He'll throw a kick to the leg. He'll throw one to the body. The other thing that he does that's a little weird, he throws nice hooks, and you saw that in that Ryan McDonald fight. I mean, his boxing looked amazing. But he'll stand there and kind of shadow box, and it's nice. I mean, you like to see a guy throw a lot of feints. There's a guy that I talk about all the time, and Matt's going to smile here, hopefully. TJ Dillashaw, he's always keeping busy. He's always doing something, but there's... Drugs. As Corey Anderson would say, there's levels to this, and TJ Dillashaw was a bantamweight champion multiple times.
He's all right.
Luis Smolka has not been. So if we have a look at the odds, Matt, Luis Smolka open to minus 135. They've moved just a very small bit. Average over on best fight odds now, minus 132. For Jose Quiñones, open a plus 107. He's now at a minus 105. So the line slightly shifted for Quiñones. Again, I cannot stress this enough. Luis Smolka missed weight a couple of weeks ago to make 135, he weighed 139, and he fought a lot of his career at flyweight. Weight cutting has been an issue, so I would not put this on my card whatsoever. Making a pick is incredibly tough, more so due to that.
Oh, yeah. Now, I am going to make the pick. Jose Quiñones should be able to get this done. There's something that I'm really stuck on. Movement beats wrestling. And it's one of the best ways. And again, I know I bring this up a lot. The best way to defend someone in basketball, don't let them get the ball. The best way to defend a takedown, don't let them touch you in the first place. And same thing with a submission. Do you know what the best way to defend a submission is? You don't get put in that position in the first place. That's what everyone always says. If you're in a triangle choke, well, you made your mistake a few positions ago to get in that spot. So for Quiñones, he can get the takedown. I think the movement's going to cause Luis Smolka a lot of trouble. I don't think Jose Quiñones will have as much success on the feet as I originally did. I do think Smolka will be able to win some of the exchanges, but it will come down to the movement of Jose Quiñones. I do think the kicks and the range are going to give Smolka a little bit of issue. I do like the busyness of Luis Smolka, but just overall, I do think Quiñones will just kind of outlast him as the fight goes on, probably win decision.
And again, I know for Quiñones, losing to Wood, losing to Perez, and also losing to Sean O'Malley, that's obviously going to negatively affect your stats. But the majority of his UFC career has been the majority of his MMA career, which is kind of weird. You don't see that very often. For Quiñones, his takedown defense is actually very good at about a 50%. His striking defense is what I wanted to get at. It's at a 66% clip. That's not that bad. Again, all of those wins, guys are no longer in the UFC. But I do like the busyness of Quiñones in his own right. He's always circling away from a lead hand. He's always doing something. That could be to a fault. Will he tire himself out? We haven't really seen it so far. I do like Jose Quiñones in this spot, again, as a slight underdog. It might be worth it. But again, Luis Smolka missing weight.
It's not worth putting anybody on. Yeah, I'm just gonna say it right now.
It's just a pick to have a pick, and I will side with the slight underdog in Jose Quiñones in this one. Now, again, in our original prediction, you had Quiñones, I had Smolka, but that weight miss, and then just a couple weeks later, you got to cut weight again. I can't honestly give you a good enough take on Luis Smolka, and I can't be confident enough to take Luis Smolka in this spot. So for those reasons, I'm going with Jose Alberto Quiñones. Matt, you're in agreement.
100%.
100%. So we're both going with Jose Quiñones to get the win over Luis Smolka in the bantamweight division. Matt, I'm really looking forward to this card. We have a great main event between Jack Hermanson and Marvin Vettori, the Italian Stallion, the Italian Dream. This should be a really good card. You better keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. We've got this as one of our Fight of the Night contenders. You have Mowgli. Gabriel Benitez taking on the guitar hero, Justin James. Matt, this fight will be contested at lightweight. It has it on the UFC site. It has it on most sites. Justin James referenced it in his interview with friend of the show, James Lynch. Shouts to our fellow Canadian. He also said that he had COVID before this fight, and Gabriel Benitez had COVID. So the first booking or original booking of this fight fell through. Both guys at one point had COVID. Kind of crazy. All right, Matt. So we talk about this one at 155 pounds. Gabriel Benitez, in his last time out, took on Omar Morales on relative short notice. Now, Morales was booked to take on Alexander Hernandez a couple weeks before. The card fell out because of the state of the world. So later on, back in Jacksonville, in steps Gabriel Benitez. And Matt, this gets referenced all the time. The fact that Javier Mendez has said that Gabriel Benitez is one of the hardest kickers, if not the hardest kicker that he's ever had at the American Kickboxing Academy, and more so than Luke Rockhold. Now, the crazy thing about it, Gabriel Benitez had a Luke Rockhold-esque injury in his last fight against Omar Morales. I've rarely seen shins get cut open that bad. Yes, I'm wearing flip-flops. Then Gabriel Benitez, he cracked that shin open really badly in that fight. Almost reminiscent, Matt, we talked about this before the video, of one Mr. Mark Hunt. Now, Gabriel Benitez loves to shoot that back leg forward, loves to whip those kicks out there, and that can definitely cause problems for a lot of guys. Now, Justin James coming into this fight, coach at Extreme Couture, he's had a wild 2020, came in on short notice at the Apex, taking on Frank the Crank Camacho, knocked him out in about 41 seconds. So the world's his oyster, the sky's the limit. Then he goes on to take on Canada's, the Maritime Zone, Gavin Tucker. And what a wild fight, Matt. I mean, Gavin Tucker got a knockdown in that one, earned a takedown, submitted him. It was an amazing fight and a great performance for Gavin Tucker. And it's kind of crazy because in Justin Jean's first fight against Frank Camacho, he earned a performance of the night. Jean's did. In the next fight, Gavin Tucker earned a performance of the night. So kind of both ends of the spectrum. Justin James, primarily known as a wrestler, spent 4 years wrestling at Olivet College in Michigan before kind of moving on to greener pastures, moving into MMA and coaching Extreme Couture. And I mean, we can go through the roster of guys that have kind of spent time there, but the Benil Dariushes, the Giga Chikadzes, the Dan Ige, so on and so forth, Misha Tate, Randy Couture. Like, there's been a lot of really good fighters that have trained there, and especially recently, Justin James working on that pedigree there. I love this fight stylistically. I think it's going to be a really good one. What do you make of this fight here?
Okay, so you say Justin James is a wrestler, and he is, but he doesn't really fight like a wrestler. He isn't going to be going for a lot of double legs on Gabriel Benitez. And if he does, that's going to be a very bad idea for a reason I'll bring up in a second. But Justin James is a good example of, I'm going to use the term, he is like Justin Gaethje, where he's going to use that defense, he's going to use his wrestling much more in a defensive style. He does have sort of that, you know, to go really old school, a Chuck Liddell style where, yes, he's got good wrestling credentials, but it's mainly used to stuff the opponent's takedowns and then throw offense of his own. The weird thing about that, though, is Gavin Tucker was able to out-wrestle Justin James, but Justin James was able to outstrike Gavin Tucker on the feet and actually drop Tucker at one point. So it's really weird because when you do look at Justin James, kind of the sum of his components don't really make up who he is as an MMA fighter, because when he is more in his element, he's that big power puncher. He can get into those brawls. The jiu-jitsu is something that worries me a little bit, because Gavin Tucker, once that fight hit the mat, he was able to really implement his game plan. Now, is that Gavin Tucker is a phenomenal grappler? And I'm sure he is. Or is Justin James one of those cases where my wrestling's good, but maybe I didn't spend enough time in the whole jiu-jitsu aspect, kind of like Sarah McMahon? Now, I'm not going to you know, jump to those kinds of conclusions. But if this fight does hit the mat, I favor Gabriel Benitez quite a bit. Benitez has phenomenal chokes. He will go for arm bars sometimes and then give up top positions, something you have to worry about, especially with a guy like Justin James. If he's able to get on top of Gabriel Benitez, I think the ground and pound could give Benitez some issues. And this is a classic fight of whoever's either backing up or whoever's off their back is the one who's going to be in the most trouble. And I know that's easy to say, but especially in this fight, if Justin James is able to get Gabriel Benitez's back up against the cage, he's really going to limit some of that movement that Benitez is known for, that really good side to side. And he will be able to unload some of those bigger shots. We saw Sadiq Youssef was able to do it against Gabriel Benitez. The difference is, Youssef will kind of go body and to the head. He does have sort of these Paulo Costa combinations where he's not just the headhunter. He will mix it up, go body, leg, and then to the head when that opens up. If Benitez is on the back foot against James, I worry about James just sort of recklessly crashing forward. It's something that he does do. He does like to duck his head and throw with power. And that's great if you are able to land those shots over the top. And with a guy like Benitez who does stand kind of upright, it could be devastating if he does land some of those big shots. But Benitez throws perfect punches down the middle. He is much more of a straight puncher than a looping shot kind of guy. And I think the best example of this in MMA was when the Korean Zombie fought Jose Aldo way back when. Because the Korean Zombie, especially at that point, he wasn't as crisp of a technician with his boxing as he is now. And he just threw looping shots where Jose Aldo just went down the middle every single time. And he could get from point A to point B quite a bit faster. So Justin James is really loading up on his shots. Gabriel Benitez can just kind of outspeed him. Play that volume game instead of I'm just gonna try and knock you out with one shot. And I do think as the fight goes on, that damage is really going to accumulate. The body kicks of Benitez is going to get to you. I think the straight shots are going to eventually get to you, and I do think a big shot will open up later on in the fight.
And I mean, Matt, I went back and watched some of Justin James' fights from the regional scene. A good example, the Brandon Noble fight, but really the James Warfield Lane fight. Again, dipping your head, throwing a wild shot, and then when he gets his opponent down, he can really use position from an open guard perspective to land a lot of shots. He's great from a full guard position. He has really good ground and pound. For Justin James, if we have a look at the odds, open a minus 115 favorite. He's now a plus 162 underdog. Gabriel Benitez, one of the biggest movers so far, and it's early on this card. Benitez open a plus 115. He's now minus 197. If we look over in Tapology, again, limited sample size, 462 total votes. 63% going Justin James, 79% going with James to win by knockout. Matt, we had a fight really similar to this fight, stylistically somewhat, but where the odds and the Tapology votes, everything didn't really kind of gel together. Luke Sanders, when he fought Nate Maness on the last card, opening the prelims, it was a lot like that. And it was really interesting to see. I see that kind of similarity here. The other thing, again, both guys had COVID. So will it play a factor? I have no idea. I'm not a doctor. The other thing that I do know, at lightweight, Gabriel Benitez in his career, 13-3 fighting at 155. For Justin James, 12-3. That according to MMA Form Guide. Overall, it's a great fight, Matt. I mean, Justin James coming in, the orthodox stance, crashing forward. Gabriel Benitez, known as a really crisp striker. Great southpaw, those whipping kicks. Again, Javier Mendez is going to play up his guy because you gotta. But Gabriel Benitez does fight like that. Now, the only issue, again, in Benitez's last 5-2-3, we look at the wins, Matt, Jason Knight and Umberto Bandanai. And I know Bandanai no longer in the UFC, and neither is Jason Knight. That Jason Knight performance is great.
Oh, yeah. He looked amazing in that fight. Now, there are a few little X factors in this fight that I'm a little concerned about. Justin James's power could get to Benitez. Benitez, to me, is like Derek Favors. I always thought he'd be a little bit better, but he's not bad by any means. And for Benitez, if he is the one on the back foot, I am concerned if he does get backed up to the cage. You know how good of a power puncher Justin James is. So if he is able to start unloading with those combinations, I'm a little worried, but here's the great news. I think if Benitez starts really well and wins the first round, it's just going to keep on getting better for him. The real question is, how long is it going to take him to kind of judge the timing of Justin James? Another thing that I always really like too, if you have a kick-dominant fighter in southpaw fighting a primary boxer who's going to be in the orthodox position, that opens up the liver kick wide open. And with a guy like Gabriel Benitez, who isn't afraid to just throw those kicks with reckless abandon, I can see that shot being open all fight long. And I really like the skill set of Gabriel Benitez in this one.
Matt, I looked up those pictures of Gabriel Benitez's shin after he fought Omar Morales. Don't look them up. I won't put them here. Don't look them up. But they sewed it up pretty good. It looked all right after the fact. So hopefully Gabriel Benitez at 100%, that shin's all well and healed. And I agree with you, Matt, in this one. I am going with Gabriel Benitez as well. But overall, this is a great fight. And Justin James certainly has a chance in this one. Great wrestler, great forward pressure. And we saw it with Gabriel Benitez in his last fight with Omar Morales. First round went really well for Gabriel Benitez. Omar Morales kept going, kept going, kept going. I really think his future's at lightweight. Don't go back down to featherweight, Omar, please. But overall, there's certainly a path to victory for Justin James. We're both going with Gabriel Benitez here in a possible fight of the night. It should be a barn burner. You're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, because we have a great card coming up on Saturday, headlined by Marvin Vettori coming in on short notice to take on Jack Hermanson. So as I said, Matt, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Matt, straight up, I'm really looking forward to this fight between former Cage Warriors bantamweight champ Ilia Topuria, looking for a second win in as many fights with the UFC in 2020, taking on the United States of America's Damon the Leech Jackson. Now, Matt, Damon Jackson returning to the UFC after a long time away. His first run, he had a loss to Yancy Medeiros, a no contest, which was a loss, but it was overturned, to Hani Jason, and then a draw against Levon Makashvili. He went away. I mean, this guy, former LFA, legacy champion, spent some time with the PFL. He was on the worst highlight reel I think I've ever seen you could be a part of with Mavlid Khabibulayev and that knee in 10 seconds where he absolutely flatlined him. But he came back. He got a win with LFA, and then he ended up back in the UFC against Mirsad Bektic not that long ago. And for Ilia Topuria, I talked about it. I mean, the fact that he had a fight just about a month and a half ago against Yusuf Salal. People thought Craig Allen was crazy taking Ilia Topuria in that fight. But I have to say, and it's not a tire pump, it might sound like it, but Ilia Topuria really did impress. And Matt, in terms of the judging on that one, he won a unanimous decision, scored 29-28 by all three. Over on MMA decisions, there were five media members that scored at 29-28. There were nine that scored at 30-27 for Topuria. There were two that scored at 30-26 for Ilia Topuria. Overall, he put on a really impressive performance against a streaking Yusuf Salal coming out of Factory X. And with Ilia Topuria, it was really tough to try and gauge what you were going to get. Because on the regional scene, he hadn't fought the best level of competition. His fight against Breon Bulon with Cage Warriors was a really fun one. That kind of got me on the Ilia Topuria train. And when I find a prospect like that, Matt, I latch on to them. They're my guys, like Piotr Jan, like Askar Askarov. Maybe I'm just an ACB guy. Who knows? But with Damon Jackson coming back into the UFC, he was a huge underdog against Mirsad Bektic. He was a 295, actually, plus 295. That was back in September. He earned a third-round guillotine win over Bektic. What can you tell me about that fight?
Listen, Mirsad's going to Mirsad. And I mean that as a compliment, but also as a huge insult. Because Mirsad Bektic, when you look at his skill set, he's a phenomenal wrestler. He's got pretty good jiu-jitsu. His striking's really good. You're probably like, wait, what's the downside? He's almost too good for his own sake, where he'll just keep on wrestling and keep on wrestling and keep on wrestling and just kind of overdo it to such a degree where he gets himself tired. Now, we had said that about Malcolm Gordon last weekend. Now, that fight didn't really make it far enough for him to wrestle himself into exhaustion, but Bektic does have that issue. And he was able to take down Damon Jackson and not have his way with him in a lot of the grappling, but he definitely was getting the better of the grappling exchanges on the mat throughout the majority of that fight.
He had a lot of control time. The sneaky part about control time, though, was the whole time that he was in control, Damon Jackson was just fishing for striped bass, and he just kept fishing for those submissions, and he kept working and working and working until it finally worked out for him.
It did, but there were a few points in that fight that were a little iffy for Damon Jackson. Bektic was able to take his back, which is never something that, you know, you're overly thrilled about, but I do really like what Damon Jackson does. He pulls that ghillie, to quote Dustin Poirier. If you go for the takedown, he is not afraid to give up position in the attempt for a submission, because he realizes how good his ground game is and how slippery he must be on the mat. So if you... This is a big problem with stats in MMA. If you look at Damon Jackson's takedown defense, I'm sure it's not very good. But the problem is, he's a fighter who's not afraid of getting taken down. I think that's a very important distinction to make.
We talk about that a lot. It seems like every week we talk about a fighter that's like this. So for Damon Jackson, he had three fights in his first run in the UFC. He had one against Mirsad Bektic. His takedown accuracy, 20%. He goes for 1.22 takedowns per 15 minutes. His takedown defense, 35%. Now, the other thing that couples in with this is the fact that he wrestled at Missouri Valley College, and he wrestled at 165, 174. He was an All-American. Those are impressive things to have in your back pocket. And then for your takedown defense to match up like that and your takedown accuracy, it's just weird. But it's because he's such a good grappler and he can figure things out in his head. His jiu-jitsu is really where it needs to be. Also a Fortis MMA guy, so you know that he's going to be working on all of those. Plus, with Save Sode and the good strikers that you have at Fortis, you're going to come out with a really well-rounded game. So I know that we had picked Mirsad Bektic on incredibly short notice. You can call us out for that in the comments if you'd like. But overall, incredibly impressed with Damon Jackson's performance in that one.
Oh, 100%. Now, this fight will be interesting because Ilya Topuria will play he is going to play the grappling game, if you will, with Damon Jackson. But Topuria does with MMA grappling what I do in UFC 4 online.
Spam overhand rights.
No, just stay in the person's face and try to outthink them constantly. And that's what Topuria does. When he's on the ground, he's always giving you something to think about. And John Danaher, it's always position and then submission. Position and then submission. And then you look at guys like Tony Ferguson, for instance, where it's just submission, 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 submission. I'm not afraid to give up position in the attempt of a submission. Ilya Topuria is more of that build where he will fish for your arm to try to get you to move a certain way, and then he'll try to work that into taking your back. He's a very intelligent grappler, and he is always making you think about something, and he's trying to make you make a mistake. He'll go for your arm when the real target is your neck, or he'll go for your neck when the real target's your arm. And I think that shows a certain intelligence in grappling that we don't see all that often in MMA, because I wouldn't really say Ilya Topuria is a jiu-jitsu fighter. I wouldn't really say he's a wrestler. I would say he mixes the two together very well, to where there's not a big transition between his wrestling and his grappling. He mixes them together where the takedown is almost a pursuit of the submission. He's very good positionally about where he lands. And I do think that's important, especially in this fight. Damon Jackson jumping that guillotine, or really any submission, he's using them in defensive cases a lot of the time. And I do think Topuria, he'll go for those big takedowns, but he's an intelligent grappler. He can get them from the clinch. He can get them. He's got really good trips as well. And on the feet, I do lean with Topuria. I like his volume. I think the leg kicks of Topuria are going to be really important in this fight, because for a guy like Damon Jackson, we saw it in the Bektic fight, he was able to just outlast Mirsad. Where with Topuria, I don't think you're going to get that opportunity. Topuria won't get himself exhausted. He'll use all that energy to make you exhausted, not really the other way around like Bektic did. So as long as his cardio isn't, not to say bad, because of course Bektic has good cardio, just his output's so high, but if he's intelligent with his output, I do think Topuria can at least be sound enough defensively to put on enough of a grappling show on Damian Jackson.
So Matt, if we have a look at the odds on this one, Ilya Topuria open a minus 170 favorite. He's now at a minus 230. For Damian Jackson, open a plus 145. He's now at a plus 185. If we have a look over at Tapology for the picks by the voters, 486 total picks, 74% going with Topuria, 65% predicting a decision win for him. Now, in the research, this and that, I'd have to ask Mr. Damon Jackson, but from what I could find, BJJ purple belt, but we know he uses it as well as he can. And for Ilya Topuria, a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Overall, I really like this fight. You brought it up well, the fact that we have a lot of people that are good at just jiu-jitsu. They're good guys, gals, with their jiu-jitsu, but they can't really work the takedown. You see that all the time. It's frustrating. You know how good of a jiu-jitsu player, how credentialed this fighter might be. They medaled at ADCCs. They even possibly won gold, but they just can't get that takedown in MMA. Ilya Topuria is one of those guys that can, and he will blast a double leg if he needs to. Now, I would not do that against Damon Jackson. That's probably a bad move, but overall, this should be a very, very good fight. And I'm siding with Ilya Topuria in this one. I like the fact that 23-year-old that has the wherewithal to really just push a steady pace. He's always looking to do something. He's always staying busy. In that fight that he had against Yusuf Zalal, a guy who is a good striker, known as a good defensive wrestler. You watch that fight that Yusuf Zalal had against Jordan Griffin, you knew that he could hang with a guy that's good at jiu-jitsu and MMA. Ilya Topuria really did a good job of winning that one over him. His average fight time for Topuria, 4 minutes and 23 seconds. And before that decision win over Yusuf Zalal, because now this number is weighted, he only had one other fight that went into the second round. Out of all of his wins, 7 of them by submission, 1 by knockout, and the 1 over Zalal by decision. I like Topuria in this one, but hey, maybe Jackson plays spoiler again.
He very well could. It is hard to disagree with the Topuria pick. I like the wrestling. I like the jiu-jitsu. And even if he can't get the takedown, I do like him on the feet as well. So it's really hard to pick against the guy who you see winning all three phases of the fight.
Matt, I'm really looking forward to this fight. We're both going with Ilya Topuria to get the win. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the previews for this card, including our new main event between Jack Hermansson and Marvin Vettori. So stick around for that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really interesting fight coming up at 125 pounds with the UFC debut of The Brick, Jimmy Flick, taking on Cody Durden. And Matt, Cody Durden debuted back earlier on this year on very short notice, replacing Luke Sanders, taking on now a former common opponent between these two guys and Chris Gutierrez, up a weight class at 135 pounds. Now, for Cody Durden, he had spent a large majority of his career at bantamweight. Now, I know if you go through his record on Tapology, there's a lot of catchweight fights peppered in there between 127 and 130 pounds. A little bit of a head scratcher, kind of worrisome. And Cody Durden, so far throughout his career, has had one fight at flyweight. He lost that fight at flyweight. That is one of his two losses in his career. But for what it's worth, in Cody Durden's UFC debut, performed admirably there. Earned a draw against Chris Gutierrez, who was coming off of a wild win. Leg kick TKO. So he goes into the fight against Durden, and it was a weird one, because for Gutierrez, you're originally going to be taking on Luke Sanders. What's Luke Sanders other than a glass cannon? He's a bit of a jack of all trades. He can do a lot of things very well. I don't know if Gutierrez kind of underestimated the short notice opponent in Durden, but he lost that first round handily. All three judges scored it a 10-8 for Cody Durden. All three judges scored the remaining two rounds 10-9s for Gutierrez. Overall, a draw. So for Durden, he looked great. For Gutierrez, bit of a head scratcher. So for Durden moving forward, we know him as a wrestler. We know him as that classic wrestle boxer, a guy that's going to kind of crash forward, look for the takedown, look for top control, smash that ground and pound. If he can get a submission, kudos to him. He's a guy that trains at American Top Team Atlanta. Now, I know on some sites they have him as ATT, and then they list the training partners as the Amanda Nunes's, the Dustin Poirier's of the world. He's an ATT Atlanta guy. Who trains out of ATT Atlanta? Well, the Lima brothers. You've got Rafael Assunção, you've got Ill Will Brooks, former Bellator champ. There are a lot of good fighters there, but you have to make the distinction between the two. For Jimmy Flick coming in here, making his UFC debut, this is a guy that has so many wins by submission. It's kind of a bit of a head scratcher when you look at his record. And you talk about some of the losses that he has so far in his career. UFC caliber fighters, Ray Rodriguez, his last loss, before that, Chris Gutierrez. And we can go down through the list, Levi Mowles, another one of those losses. But those are all pretty high-level opponents. Now, the wins, maybe not the highest of caliber, but when you look at a guy's record, being a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, having 13 of 15 pro wins by submission, very, very, you know, important, especially going into a fight like this, because as far as styles, and styles always make fights, this makes for a very interesting fight. I would almost consider it like a B grade when you compare this to Nate Landwehr and Movsar Evloev. Yeah, but this is still a really good fight. I'm really looking forward to it. I don't know if both guys stick at 25, if this is maybe a one-off. That remains to be seen. But I'm really looking forward to this one.
So am I. Now, hashtag flyweight never die. It is always nice seeing the UFC bring in more flyweight talent or just have more guys in the flyweight division, because you know that, well, for the 13 fighters there, they need new opponents at a certain point. And I do think both guys will be compelling matchups for some of the other guys in the division if they do choose to stay down at 125. This fight is kind of odd, though, because I can see it going two completely different ways. We're either going to get a really fun scramble fest between these two guys, or it's going to be one of those Kamaru Usman, Colby Covington fights where it's okay, we're both so good at grappling that it's going to force the stand-up out of the two of us. Now, for Cody Durden, he is definitely the more powerful out of these two guys. On the feet, Jimmy Flick will give you a lot of different looks. He's not afraid to throw the calf kick. He's not afraid to go to the body with his kicks either. The thing about him, though, and especially the fact that Cody Durden is such a good wrestler, I'm a little worried that if Flick does get a little carried away with some of those kicks, Durden could catch them, and then that just makes the takedown attempt so much easier for him. And once this fight hits the mat, that's where the real fun starts, because Flick, when you say 13 of his 15 wins have come by submission, that's not even doing it justice. It's not like he's just getting arm bars or he's just getting chokes. You look at this man's record, anaconda submissions, Darce chokes, rear naked chokes. He really doesn't discriminate, and he is a threat no matter where the fight takes place on the mat. And for Cody Durden, his fight against Duke Gutierrez, I like that we saw just a little bit of everything from him. We saw how good his grappling can be when he's on the offensive. We saw some of the holes in his striking game. We did see his cardio start to fade. But again, Chris Gutierrez is a very good UFC caliber fighter. So having a draw with a guy like that, there's no shame in that. But I do like that we just saw a lot of Cody Durden in that fight. Durden on top is going to be a huge threat for Flick, and Flick can't get into that, and we talk about this all the time, he can't get into that Louis Smolka where he's on his back, he is the comfortable grappler off his back, trying to go for submissions that he's not getting, because Cody Durden will rain down ground and pound on him, and it is hellacious. Now, the thing about Cody Durden, he creates a lot of space, and that can open some submission threats for Jimmy Flick off of his back, so I do think that this could be one of those, you know, Cody Durden getting a lot of takedowns throughout the fight, and then Flick potentially getting the submission as the fight goes on. But it's just that this fight and these two athletes match up so well together that I don't really care where the fight takes place because it should be exciting no matter what.
Jimmy Flick gets hit. And it's not to say that Cody Durden doesn't, but if you go back and watch that fight against Ray Rodriguez, they exchange. Rodriguez, a much better striker. Now, I know his short notice UFC debut didn't go very well for Ray Rodriguez. It went the way of Jimmy Flick against Ray Rodriguez. But in that one, they get into a clinch position, or if they even got in close, Rodriguez would start popping up with the knees, hit Flick hard, followed it up, finished him in that one. Now, Flick obviously on a win streak since then, really tied things together. In 2020, he became the freestyle cage fighting flyweight champion. It's hard to say without laughing. That's a silly name for an organization. He also became the LFA flyweight champ, for what that's worth. And he came in on short notice, replacing JP Baez to take on Nate Smith, on Dana White's Contender Series Week 5 this year, earned a contract, and now he gets to face off against Cody Durden. Like I said, Durden, the one fight at flyweight, all those weird catchweight bouts, so maybe the weight cut could be an issue. I know weighed in at a healthy 135.5, again, that on short notice, taking on Gutierrez. And I remember watching back that prediction video to kind of try and get a little bit more intel on Cody Durden. The fact that at that time, we weren't sure if that fight was going to take place at 35 or 45. So a lot of question marks around this fight. You look at it, and I mean, we talk about Cody Durden. He can crash forward. It's kind of a similar game plan to a lot of those wrestle boxers. We got another one on this card, like a Justin Jaynes. He can always rely on his wrestling. He doesn't. He's more than capable of brawling. Cody Durden can do that as well. Went 2 of 13 of his overall takedown attempts against Chris Gutierrez. But again, Gutierrez is a pretty good fighter. Has a win over Flick, like we had said. If we have a look at the odds for this fight, Matt, I was a little bit surprised. Flick opened on minus 222 average on best fight odds. He's now minus 177 for Durden. Opened up a plus 183. He's now at a plus 146. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, limited sample size, but at a 677 total votes, 82% going Flick, 70% going Flick by submission. That's the sexy pick. I mean, that's kind of been the story of his career. What's your take on this one overall?
So I really do think this fight comes down to cardio more than anything else. Because with Cody Durden, you see at the start of a fight, if he is able to get it to the ground, he is a big guy, especially for this weight class. And he's extremely explosive. And if he's able to get the back of Jimmy Flick, I don't care how good of a grappler Jimmy Flick is, just the added physicality of Cody Durden is going to give him problems throughout this fight. As the fight progresses, though, I do see Jimmy Flick kind of fighting his way back into it. And here's the really important thing, too. If Cody Durden gets the takedown, Jimmy Flick isn't completely out of the fight. If Jimmy Flick is able to get on top of Cody Durden, that's by far the most dangerous position for either guy in this fight. Because if Flick is the one on top, he's going to be able to threaten with arm bars and chokes. And he's really going to force Durden to be uncomfortable off of his back. So it comes down to, can Cody Durden get enough takedowns and at least get enough damage early on in the fight so to where Jimmy Flick's, I'll say cardio advantage, doesn't really kick into play in, you know, late second, early third round. I'm saying Jimmy Flick is going to win by submission. Not my most confident pick. I do think this will be a really fun fight, though.
It is a really tough one to gauge because you look at Cody Durden's career that he had with NFC and the regional scene in the U.S. Southeast. Good career. I mean, in one night, he won a boxing fight, he won a kickboxing fight, and he won an MMA
fight.
Which
is wild.
It is wild, and he can be a jack of all trades. I just really worry, what's the ceiling with Cody Durden? He had a really good fight against Chris Gutierrez. Now we're popping down to 125, where we're 0-1 in our career, and we have 13 pro fights. Why? Like, it's just, maybe it's a path of least resistance to get to the top, and this is the perfect fight for him to take. And you know what? I'd be somewhat in agreement. I think you fight a guy like Jimmy Flick that has 20 pro fights, all of them but one on the regional scene, or call Dana White's Contender Series, whatever you want. Maybe all 20 on the regional scene. And he's had good results. The one thing that I worry about for Jimmy Flick going forward, 4 of his total losses are by knockout. That's not a great sign. I really don't love the stand-up that he has. Now, in the Nate Smith fight, yeah, he looked good. He looked really good. He was throwing those nice hooks. He was closing distance well. And when he needed to, he could slap that calf kick, and it was hot and heavy. It was very well timed, too. He caught Smith almost flat-footed at times, and that's when those calf kicks really do most of their damage. And he switches stance really well, too. I just don't know if he's going to have the time to do it against a guy like Durden that's really trying to close that gap at all points.
No, all those points are really fair. And I do like what you brought up. Flick and Durden will have to make some adjustments to their styles if they do plan on staying at the flyweight division, because this isn't the flyweight division from 2015 where there wasn't a lot of guys who could go out there and get the knockout. Right now at flyweight, Figueiredo can knock you out, Pantoja can knock you out, Askar Askarov hits really hard. Like, there's so many good finishers at this weight class who aren't going to fall for the, you know, kind of one-trick pony-ish. If you don't get taken down by Jimmy Flick, or if Cody Durden can't take you down, those upper elite guys are going to kind of have their way with both these guys. So I will be interested to see both careers moving forward. But yeah, I still have Flick.
And I mean, to offer up the final pick, because I've tried to go both ways with it, I do like Jimmy Flick ever so slightly in this fight. Again, he's going to be fishing for submissions constantly. Cody Durden, again, with that forward pressure, maybe looking for the takedowns. Now, is he going to be able to be taken down? Will Jimmy Flick be able to inflict the takedown on him? I don't totally know that one. But again, in those clinch positions, definitely dangerous. Cody Durden could certainly catch Jimmy Flick with a dirty, nasty shot. We've seen it in his fights as well. But I'm leaning ever so slightly to Flick. I do not like these odds.
Not
the fact
all.
That Flick opened an average minus 222, he hasn't fought the right level of competition to the way where, you know, you get 20 pro fights. I would expect some of those wins to be some big names. There are none. The losses are to bigger regional names, but the wins aren't. So I kind of worry about that a little bit, where Cody Durden faced that good competition. Again, now you're playing MMA math because Flick lost to Gutierrez by finish in the third round. Durden, you know, had a draw and had a competitive, an incredibly competitive first round. So it is a tough one to call. I can certainly see people going either way. The Tapology voters going with Flick, the odds going with Flick. We're both going with Flick.
Ever so slightly.
Probably one of the least confident picks on the card, but I am really looking forward to this fight, Matt, because hey, sky's the limit. You never know, especially in this flyweight division. So we're both going with Jimmy Flick in this fight to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. We have an impromptu main event between Marvin Vettori and Jack Hermanson. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. We got a weird fight at lightweight between, it used to be Handsome Matt Wyman. They don't use the nickname anymore. He shaved his beard and head. Matt Wyman is taking on the UFC newcomer, Jordan Levitt, the Monkey King. And Matt, for Jordan Levitt, a guy coming in from Syndicate MMA, and I have nothing but good things to say about Syndicate MMA. You go on Jordan Levitt's Instagram, you go on Facebook, Twitter, whatever. You go on the socials, Instagram. A lot of pictures with Serena DeJesus and Roxanne Modafferi. But we've seen a lot of success outside of just those two. We've seen a lot of success out of two fighters primarily in the last couple of weeks. Sean Strickland and Sasha Palatnikov. So Jordan Levitt kind of looking to follow in the footsteps of some of his teammates recently. John Wood and the crew have really been putting on a great show this past fall into this winter. For Matt Wyman, Matt, back in 2012-2013, Matt Wyman was a force to be reckoned with in the lightweight division until our boy, Halifax, Nova Scotia's own TJ Grant, ran through him like a buzzsaw. It was UFC on Fox 6, finished him on the prelims, and then Matt Wyman had a fight against, I love doing this, BKFC's own Isaac Valley Flag, beat him, and then took almost 5 years off. And it's a bit of a head-scratcher. He really hasn't come out and said a whole lot about why he took the time off. There was some injury talks. I know if you go on Tapology, he had a fight that was booked in like 2015, fell out, and it says that it was a back injury for Matt Wyman. But he kind of went away. And then all of a sudden he came back, and he took a fight against Luis Pena. Didn't look good in the fight against Luis Pena. So what did they do? They put him out there against another hot prospect in Joe Selecki. What happened? He didn't look good against Joe Selecki. So for Matt Wyman at 37 years old, he's 16-9. The biggest question mark on this card. But is he? I mean, that's the trouble. The trouble with fighters like this is, well, do I bother even talking about the start of their career that was, you know, 8-9 years ago when Matt Wyman was really in his prime? Or do I start talking about those last two fights where he looked like he's missed not even a step? He's missed 3 or 4 steps against, now, albeit against good guys like young up-and-comers. Say what you will about Luis Pena. He has the tools. They're there. He just has to bring them together. And for Joe Selecki, a guy that I wish we get to see a little bit more of because he is a very hot prospect. So Matt Wyman taking on another really good prospect in Jordan Levitt, a guy that's undefeated so far, a guy that has plenty of finishes on his record, 5 submissions overall. Jordan Levitt really putting things together. 4-0 as an amateur as well. So Levitt really riding high. Also, cool as ice picture on Tapology. Mr. Photogenic, mid-fight, grabbing the iron bar, looking dead in the camera, like having fun.
It's pretty great.
Listen, Jordan Leavitt has more than a good shot in this fight, but what can you tell me about Matt Wyman?
Okay, it is really weird when we do talk about fighters who have had two very distinct parts of their career, and I always think of a George St. Pierre, for instance. He took all these years off, and when he did come back, we saw a new and improved version because you knew that he used all the time off. The Korean Zombie is another great example. I know he lost to Brian Ortega, but he'd done his mandatory military service, and you could tell that, okay, yes, he was working while he was over there, but he was training. He was getting ready for his comeback, and he was getting better. Matt Wyman, when he made his return, you knew Matt Wyman in his first iteration. He had decent volume striking, and if the fight went to the mat, he was phenomenal. He had really good leg locks, really good grappling. The sport has kind of moved past a lot of what Matt Wyman was really good at, and the Luis Pena fight really proves it. Now, I'm a lot higher on Luis Pena than I know a lot of other people are. I do think that his skill set is a very advanced one. I just don't think he always fights up to his potential, but what he did to Matt Wyman should be illegal. He just beat the brakes off him, whether it be on the feet, whether it be on the mat. And then the grappling is where you expect Matt Wyman to have an advantage, if he did have any. Luis Pena, there was no issue at all in that fight. He was just able to float on top of Wyman, get a lot of ground and pound damage off. And every time Wyman did go for leg attacks, and I might as well just say this now, Trevor Whitman, they don't have him enough on the broadcast. They should have to bring him on like once a round, I think, if not twice. He had brought up a really good point in that fight. The leg locks and the leg attacks and the transitions that Matt Wyman was going for in the Luis Pena fight, they were very advanced for 2013. But the issue is, a lot of people now, the sport just moves so fast. Same thing in basketball. In 5 years, things just keep on moving and you do get left behind. And with Matt Wyman, it's not like when he fought Luis Pena and he came back, he had like Danaher Death Squad level leg locks. No, his game was still very much the same. And we've just kind of seen the evolution of the sport. Now, it is unfortunate. And this is a fight where Matt Wyman could have success because Jordan Leavitt's going to go out there and grapple with him. I really doubt he's going to stand on the outside and kind of expose some of the, you know, striking weaknesses that Matt Wyman has. And that's the other part with Matt Wyman. It's very strange. A lot of guys who do have really good jiu-jitsu, who are comfortable off their back, throw a lot of kicks. They're just very comfortable with it because they're not afraid of being taken down. Matt Wyman doesn't throw a ton of kicks. He throws a little short leg kick to the inside with his left leg. His striking's okay, but he doesn't accentuate his reach enough. He's not a guy like Neil Magny who will pop that jab out, pop that jab out. Matt Wyman will kind of wait for the fight to come to him, and that does concern me at this stage in his career. And against a guy like Jordan Leavitt, it kind of feels like they're doing to Matt Wyman what they tried to do to Francis Ngannou after he lost to Stipe. So he loses to Stipe, loses to Derek Lewis, and the UFC goes, well, who's his worst matchup? Curtis Blaydes, he's a wrestler, we'll make him fight him. For Matt Wyman, you've lost to a guy who can do a little bit of everything. You lost to Selecki, another guy who can do a little bit of everything. But again, you kind of get dominated in the grappling of those fights. Now you're fighting Jordan Leavitt, who really is a grappling specialist. So there's just so many question marks around Matt Wyman. And maybe he did need two performances to kind of shake some of that rust off. Maybe this is the fight where he is going to show it's one of those y'all must have forgot, where we do have kind of the veteran showing the young gun, kind of putting him in his place. I just don't really see it. I don't see him having a big advantage on the feet. If the fight does go to the mat, Jordan Leavitt is an absolute wizard. I know I've talked a lot about Matt Wyman, but the things he can get done on the mat are serious.
So, Matt, let's talk about Jordan Leavitt's submissions. So, if you look at it, he had the win on Dana White's Contender Series week one this past summer, earning the contract, getting the win over Luke Flores, round one arm triangle.
Beautiful submission.
Before that, Levon Lewis, he has a second round anaconda choke with LFA. Before that, Izzy Williams' decision. Before that, Johnny Walker. No, not that Johnny Walker. First round heel hook in 17 seconds. Do you know how adept you have to be to get a heel hook in 17 seconds? That's Ryan Hall type stuff right there. Ray Ostrander gets a first round arm triangle choke. Before that, a decision. And in his debut, he has a submission win. So overall, Jordan Leavitt really firing all cylinders. And he's another one of those fighters we talk about. When you have a really good grappling specialist early on in their career to be training at Syndicate, there's so many good fighters, so many good coaches to round out Jordan Leavitt's game that, yes, maybe Jordan Leavitt, and we got to put this like cards on the table. Some people that they've signed from Dana White's Contender Series now, they might not be the most UFC ready. I mean, Jordan Leavitt, credit where credit's due. Good fighter. But he's 7-0. It is early. What do you do after you beat Matt Wyman? That's a big question. Who do you put Jordan Leavitt up against at lightweight?
Hopefully
this is the most stacked division. Does Jordan Leavitt go on and win 4, 5, 6 fights in a row and then he's fighting for the title tomorrow? No, it's such a stacked division. So it is a good litmus test to see, well, where's Jordan Leavitt at?
And it's a good test as to, well, Matt Wyman, you lose three fights in a row since taking almost 5 years off.
37.
Probably time to go out the door. I have a really hard time with this one because, again, Matt Wyman, tale of two totally different careers. Jordan Leavitt, really hot prospect, really good grappler. If we have a look at the odds, Matt Wyman opened a plus 225 underdog. He's now a plus 297 average on best fight odds. For Jordan Leavitt, open a minus 305 favorite. He's now minus 389. And if we look over on Tapology, the biggest skew in the votes, 647 total votes, 95% going Leavitt, 63% having to win by submission. I have to say this. Jordan Leavitt right now, at this point in his career, isn't on the same level as Joe Selecki. I would hate for them to match those two up. And again, Luis Pena, hot and cold. He's got the tools. Some nights he's hot, some nights he's not. But overall, Luis Pena is a good fighter as well. So Wyman, it's a bit of a step down, but for Jordan Leavitt, it definitely is a winnable fight here.
Oh, 100%. Now, great point, by the way, because I do agree. Jordan Leavitt is a little bit green to be in the UFC. I would agree with that. But this fight stylistically just kind of plays into his strengths. You know Matt Wyman, the takedown defense isn't phenomenal because, again, he is quite comfortable off of his back. But with a fighter like Jordan Leavitt, do you really want to test your grappling against a guy who 5 of 7 wins are by submission? And even in the fights where they've gone to decision, he's so dominant, especially from the top position in his control, that I really don't see a lot of opportunities for Matt Wyman to create that separation, either get the fight back up to his feet or go for a submission of his own. So I do see this pretty cut and dry for Jordan Leavitt.
Matt, both of us going with Jordan Leavitt in this one. Really looking forward to this card. There's a lot of under-the-radar fights. Movsar Evloev taking on a really tough out, Nate Landwehr. There's all sorts of good ones littered through this card, so make sure you check out the playlist and keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, Matt, let's get into it. Straight up funky weird fight coming up at heavyweight. We have John Volante, the longtime light heavyweight in the UFC, taking on Jake the Prototype Collier. And Matt, we broke down Jake Collier's return to the UFC, and he'd been off for a very long time, about 3 years since he took on Marcel Fortuna, won a decision at 205 pounds. He looked good in that fight. It was a back and forth. It's a really fun fight if you want to go back and watch it. We watched it tonight.
I guess a good opponent, too.
Yeah, it was a good fight. And overall, Jake Collier mixing it up, throws a really nice left hook. He mixes kicks in well, too, and he did a middleweight as well. And, I mean, you look at his record overall, plenty of stoppage wins, 5 wins by knockout, 3 by submission, and only 3 decisions. So Jake Collier, certainly a finisher. But that's the thing. He took a really long time off. He had USADA issues. There were some injuries. And his progression, or rather regression, from 205 to 265 has been odd. And I went back, had a read through E. Spencer Kite's article with UFC.com, fellow Canadian, that he had with Jake Collier. And Collier kind of talked about his weight cut at 205, the fact that, yeah, he'd fight at 205. But on the night of the fight, he'd be like 230, 235,
yeah,
something like that.
Dude.
Jake Collier weighed in for his return at 264 pounds against Tom Aspinall. And that was just this past summer. Now, Matt, I have to preface this. Big Tom Aspinall guy. I mean, he trained with Tyson Fury. He's taught Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, this guy is, we talk finished products. Tom Aspinall had, you know, I would say a lack of MMA experience maybe coming into the UFC. But look at the way the guy fights.
He's like, a guy who fights kind of like he spent 4 years in college and then got drafted. He's not learning on the job. He already has all those skills in his back pocket. So I do agree. I do think it's kind of hard to take a lot from the Tom Aspinall fight.
That's the thing. Jake Collier, when he fought at middleweight, when he fought at light heavyweight, he mixed everything up very well. He would throw about every fifth strike a kick and they would land and they would look good. And he'd throw kicks to the head. He went into the fight against Tom Aspinall, and Matt, the fight ended so quick, and it's against such a good opponent that it's tough to really gauge a lot. But Jake Collier, for the first 15 seconds of that fight, it was like, hey, you know, I know he doesn't look like he used to, but he's fighting the way that he used to fight. And then Tom Aspinall cracks him and drops him like Jake Paul against Nate Robinson. And that was all she wrote.
Just sad.
For John Volante in his return to heavyweight, and I say return because I remember when he beat Ed Herman in good old Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. I asked him after that fight in the media scrum, hey, John, you're going to fight at heavyweight. I know at the start of your career you did. You had a lot of success. Light heavyweight. We're getting a lot of young up-and-comers. What's the play? And at that time, John Volante was like, yeah, I'd do it. Sure. Well, then he lost to Mikhail Olashechuk, and then he had to. So John Volante moves up, fights Maurice Green.
One of the weirdest fights I've ever seen.
He's fighting an all right fight. I mean, by John Volante standards, it wasn't terrible. Until the very end, when he did what Mike Tyson did against Keith McBride and just kind of gave up.
Yeah, you really can't say it any better than that. Jean Volante is stuck in a very strange place to be as a striker. Now, I'm going to mention Paul Felder, but I mean this that Paul Felder uses this in a very good way. Paul Felder, I wouldn't say has crippling power. I think he has very good power, but he also doesn't have an overabundance of output. He's kind of in that weird in-between for both. The difference is Paul Felder just as a technician, he's super good defensively, and when he does hit you, it is going to start to damage you, and he can sort of accumulate that as the fight goes on. Jean Volante's in the same boat, but I don't mean that as a positive, where Jean Volante's not going to be a guy who's going to keep a very high guard, going to start, you know, looking for the openings that his opponent brings them, and then starts to pick them apart technically as the fight progresses. Jean Volante, you know what you're going to get. He fights like he's outside of a Buffalo Wild Wings, and it's fun to watch. Jean Volante puts on exciting matchups, and I know the wins and losses, they're a little deceiving, and his record doesn't look all that great, but Jean Volante did knock out Corey Anderson. Like, he has good wins on his record. He was just one of these guys, he always heard about how great he could be and never really realized his potential. And I do think we're dealing with two athletes who aren't fighting in their prime weight classes. I'm sure the weight cut's very hard on both guys to get down to 205. But if, again, to bring up Paul Felder, if guys like that are able to cut a tremendous amount of weight the week of a fight, it's not a good look for when Jean Volante shows up. And when you saw him at 205, he's in very good shape. I would say...
That picture's, it's from UFC.com, full disclosure, but that's definitely light heavyweight, like, Jean Volante.
Jean Volante at 205, he's built kind of like Eric Anders. He's just sort of thick across the shoulders, just kind of a big guy, barrel-chested, if you will.
Both football guys.
Him at heavyweight doesn't look like a professional athlete. And I know, Matt, the eye test doesn't work, but it does kind of look like a guy who's realized that, okay, at this stage of my career, I'm probably not going to work my way up the ranks at 205. Maybe heavyweight, I might not need to put in as much training as I did to get down to 205, and I could just fight at heavyweight. The issue is, if you are in these matchups with the Jake Colliers of the world, it feels like you're always one loss away from getting cut. And I don't mean that as a disparagement towards either guy, but it's just kind of where they are at their careers. And for Jean Volante, you do remember some of those good performances that he was able to put on at 205. The Sapek Safarov fight was a really fun one. Again, the Corey Anderson one. That was
future probably Bellator champ, beast in 25.
Exactly. And that one's the one that is going to kind of jump out at you. But again, Corey Anderson doesn't have the best chin in the world, but still, to get a stoppage win over a guy like that shows that where Jean Volante's potential was at one point. And just to kind of see where he's at heavyweight, the fight against Maurice Greene was so strange because it was one of these sort of slow, brooding fights. There wasn't a lot going on. And then the third round, Jean Volante did seem like he was picking up steam a little bit. And then he drops Maurice Greene, kind of wastes himself going for the finish, and you can tell how exhausted he is. And Maurice Greene's not like a, you know, Fabricio Verdum on his back, where it's every second that you're on the mat with him, you got to watch where your arms are, where your neck, where your legs are. Maurice Greene, I would say, is a very average grappler. He's not as good at grappling as the top tier guys, but, you know, I'd say he's slightly above average. Jean Volante just kind of gave up because he's getting hugged. And I don't think that's because Jean Volante was really getting choked badly by that choke. I think a lot of that came down to cardio issues. And that's what it is. I'm probably picking Jean Volante in this fight, and those are the positives I can say about him. Jake Collier, I think at 205, if he is able to make that weight cut back down, and we are able to see some of the signs that, some of the promise, I guess, if you will, that he was able to show at 205 pounds, I think he can get this fight won. It's just really hard to go by. What is heavyweight Jake Collier? I know he can't beat Tom Aspinall, but I know most guys in heavyweight can't beat Tom Aspinall. So this is a very hard fight to predict either way.
It is. And I mean, if we have a look at the odds, Matt, Jean Volante open an average minus 161 favorite on best fight odds is now an average of a minus 213. For Jake Collier, plus 134, now at a plus 173. So there's money coming in on Jean Volante. You're betting low-level heavyweights. Did you watch Josh Parisian and Parker Porter on the main card of last week's card?
Exciting stuff.
It was what it was. Overall, on Tapology, you had 522 total votes, 83% going with Volante, 61% going with him to win by knockout. Again, with Jean Volante, where was it? Hofstra? That's where he played football. He was also a Division I wrestler, so there's that in his back pocket. He's a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. Murray Screen kind of exposed that one. With Jake Collier, again, it's kind of like a fear of the unknown. Well, he fought a good fighter. I almost said great, but we don't know that yet. And Tom Aspinall, and he got flatlined. And the last fight that he won was 3 years ago against Marcel Fortuna. And then, I mean, before that, if we talk his fifth to last fight, it was 5 years ago. So it's really tricky to tell what you're going to get with a guy like Jake Collier. I said Keith McBride earlier on in the video. I meant Kevin McBride. That's who beat Mike Tyson. So there's that. Matt said disparagement. He meant disparagement. So overall, It's been a weird video. It's been a weird fight. It's tough to call. But, I mean, with Jean Volante, there's usually some pressure. There's usually some volume. And if he can kind of push a bit of a pace against Jake Collier, I think he should be able to take home a win here. But I would not put this fight on my ticket whatsoever.
Yeah, if you do, you shouldn't bet money. Just, again, low-level heavyweights, they're two very big men who are going to be throwing, I hate to say it, but they're going to be throwing somewhat sloppy punches at each other, and someone's going to land. Volante has decent power. Like, he did drop Maurice Greene in a heavyweight fight, so I at least know a little bit about what I'm going to get from Jean Volante at heavyweight. I know he'd be a guy who wouldn't beat Tom Aspinall, so again, you're dealing with two guys who, there's so many question marks around it. Jean Volante should not be a 2-1 favorite, well, or kind of sitting around those odds. So I do think Jean Volante is going to get the win. I'm not confident in the pick, and it really could go either way.
Matt, both going with Jean Volante somewhat reluctantly, but the rest of the card is a great card. We got a lot of really good matchups. Okay. We already talked about fight of the night. Mowgli Benitez taking on Justin James. You got a great one between Movsar Evloev and a really tough out in Nate Landwehr. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Straight up, this is my favorite fight on this card. Matt, we talked about this before we even started filming this video. The perfect quote for this is Bellator's heavyweight, oh boy, Jake Hager. And to really get this quote right, he was rock hard with emotion after one of his fights. I'm rock hard with emotion for this fight, just figuratively speaking, but also Manscaped. Check it out. Overall, Nate Landwehr taking on Movsar Evloev. We're talking about a couple of former M1 Global champions. For Evloev, the bantamweight champion. For Nate Landwehr, the featherweight champion. These guys both headlined, one on top of another. M1 Challenge 95, back when Craig Allen was watching every single M1 Challenge there was. And that was a great one. Battle of the Mountains number 7. It was crazy because it was like in mountains, but in a valley, and then it's open air, and they use the Rage, you know, the ring cage hybrid that M1's so well known for. But overall, good performances by both men there. They kept their belts. But overall, in this fight in the UFC, Nate Landwehr is an absolute wild man. He's a good wrestler. He can brawl. He can get knocked out by Herbert Burns and then come back and have a great performance against a guy you know and love in Darren the Damage Elkins, and one of the greatest tattoos in all of MMA. Nate Landwehr really put it on Elkins in that fight, and really overall in his career has fought that way. I mean, just absolute wild man. For Movsar Evloev, he really fights to his strengths, and this is a guy that is a master of sport in Greco-Roman wrestling. And Matt, we don't often talk about Greco-Roman wrestlers in MMA, with a few exceptions. I mean, Marco Madsen, the Olympian, Movsar Evloev, there's not a whole lot of cases where it works and you can go back to that base all the time, because a lot of head and arm throws and a lot of upper body throws, they just don't tend to work all that well in MMA. You just don't see it all that often, especially men's MMA. For Movsar Evloev in his UFC tenure, 3 big wins over guys like Sungwoo Choi. He picked up a decision there. He also picked up a decision over Enrique Barzola, a really busy fighter. And then back in July, a win over Mike Grundy, a fellow wrestler, a fight that had already been booked a while before, so it was brewing, and that was a really fun fight to watch.
It was. And with Evloev, he's a really interesting grappler because he'll kind of give up the takedown to promote the scramble, and it's a really fun thing to watch, too. And with an opponent like Nate Landwehr, this is one of those fights where you don't really have to worry about long bouts of inactivity, because Nate Landwehr, like, if Spike Carlisle decided I'm going to use my craziness for craziness' sake in the cage, he would be Nate Landwehr. Nate Landwehr will walk forward with reckless abandon. And like you mentioned, it's not just like this is a new phase of his career. This has just been the story throughout. And I like what Nate Landwehr brings. He's a great litmus test for anybody, even though he's had kind of a short career in the UFC, because you know what you're going to get from him. And it's nice to see. If Evloev is a guy who doesn't like getting hit, if he's a guy who has any cardio issues, Nate Landwehr is the type of opponent that is going to show all the holes in your game, because he can just do a little bit of everything. If he's going for the takedown, we'll see how good is Evloev scrambles. How good are they really? Because Landwehr will be able to keep up with him. He's got a really high pace and he's great at using it. Nate Landwehr is kind of like my new Clint Guida. He's just a younger version of him. You know you're going to get a great fight from him no matter what. Yes, he got finished early by Herbert Burns, and that was just a wild way to get knocked out. But even up until that, what happened? He was crashing forward, kind of using that recklessness to his advantage. And with a fighter like Evloev, I always wonder, is all that chaos and confusion going to hurt him, or is it going to help them? Because we do see really good technicians, and I would say Evloev is in the more of the technician boat of these two. Really good technicians either thrive under that pressure or they don't do well with it at all. So it will be really interesting to see. Now, with all that said, I think pretty much based on their skill sets, Evloy is better at everything. He has the more crisp stand-up. He has the more developed ground game. But again, all that chaos that Nate Landwehr brings into the fight can get rid of all that technique. And it will be interesting to see, okay, can Movsar Evloev sort of navigate through all of that chaos? If he is able to start landing clean shots early on, and if he's able to back up Nate Landwehr, he's going to have so much success throughout this fight. Landwehr has to be in your face to really implement his game plan, whereas Evloev, he could be the one backing up. He could be the one going forward, being the aggressor. So I'm just really curious to see kind of how both guys react to each other. I know that's a very broad statement, but in this fight, it will be really interesting to see sort of the give and take between the pressure that these two guys.
And we talked about guys that these two have fought in the past. And for Movsar Evloev coming up on the regional scene, a lot of good names. I mean, Lee Morrison's a guy. He got knocked out by Aaron Pico in Bellator, but you might know him. And then another name from that M1 global scene, a guy who ended up becoming champ after Evloev left, the guy who has a fight coming up against Umar Nurmagomedov, rebooked, supposed to be on that Conor card, Sergey Morozov. So for Movsar Evloev, some decent wins. And again, we mentioned those three so far in the UFC. For Nate Landwehr, some good names too. I mean, Adam Townsend, who's in one of our thumbnails, one of the early interviews that we had on the YouTube version of Fight Night Picks. And Victor Kolesnik, he beat him twice over with M1. So overall, again, good pressure from Nate Landwehr. Kind of shoddy takedown defense, but again, he's a wild guy. He does have good wrestling. That's the weird thing. His takedown defense isn't great, but it's not a huge shot on his wrestling. It's good. His defense just isn't great.
And I think a lot of that does come from the pressure that he has. When you're always moving forward, you're forcing your opponent to react to you. And a lot of the times, if your back's up against the cage, you can go right, you can go left, you can go straight forward. The best way to go straight forward is shoot that takedown. And that has been where Landwehr has sort of struggled. His over-aggression does get him hurt. And the Fabricio Verdum, Stipe Miocic is kind of this point to the highest level, but if you walk into a shot, it just makes that shot a lot harder. Now, of course, Fabricio Verdum just sprinted at Stipe with his hands down, and I doubt that's going to happen in this fight. But that forward momentum of Landwehr, I think, will get him caught as this fight goes on. If Evloev can sort of stick and move and stick and move, Landwehr's just going to keep on getting more damage and more damage against him. And as this fight progresses, you know Evloev's cardio is going to be there throughout the whole 15 minutes. And with Landwehr, it is one of those cases with his output of, is he going to make himself tired because his output is so high? Now, in the Darren Elkins fight, Darren Elkins is going to play that game with you, and he will fight at the pace that you're comfortable with fighting. So Landwehr, although the pace of that fight was very high, he was able to, you know, keep it throughout. With Evloev, you're going to be running into that wall a lot of times with your Landwehr, and the real question is, how many times can he do that and just keep up the aggression and keep up the aggression? I think at a certain point, he is going to have to kind of pull back on the reins because Evloev is going to be the one landing clean shots.
And I mean, if Nate Landwehr is going to win, because we're going to talk about the stats coming up soon, Nate Landwehr has never won a fight by submission. I would expect if he's going to get a win here, it's going to be awfully tough to knock out Movsar Evloev. So maybe you try and submit him, but again, it's never happened so far in his career, in Landwehr's career. It should be a really good fight. So let's talk about those odds, Matt. Movsar Evloev opened a -350 favorite. He's now an average -558 on best fight odds. For Nate Landwehr, opened up a +285. He's now at a +400. I'm sure that there's people out there that are listening to this. You're going to take a shot on Nate Landwehr. Here's something to kind of add to it. So in the fight that Evloev had against Sungwoo Choi, here's the scores. Scores of 29-27, 129-26. You don't see that very often. Against Enrique Barzola, two scores of 29-28, 130-27. In the fight against Mike Grundy, 230-27s, 129-28. So he has lost rounds in the UFC, but he's also had 10-8 rounds too. So if you're Nate Landwehr, you're going to get a win here. You got to overcome those odds that are insane. They're absolutely insane.
You know a guy's good when the worst thing you can say about him is, well, he's lost rounds. Like, that's the type of fighter we're dealing with. Where the best thing we can say is, well, I mean, he could have lost like 2 minutes and 31 seconds of a 5 minute period. That's the most disparaging thing we can say against Movsar Evloev. Like, that's the level of athlete. And I do think that the odds they're more out of respect for what Evloev's ceiling could be than they are against what Nate Landwehr has done in the UFC to this point. Because I do think it is somewhat disrespectful to have a guy as a 5-1 underdog who is coming off a win off Darren Elkins, who, yes, he's a little bit older in his career, but Darren Elkins is still a really good win. And if you are able to have a Darren Elkins fight with Darren Elkins and beat him at that, that proves a lot. So it's really hard to pick Nate Landwehr, But that's only because of who his opponent is and how confident I am in Evloev moving forward.
Matt, if we have a look at the topology picks too, just final nail in the coffin. 514 total votes, 90% going Evloev, 79% picking him to win by decision. Now, again, we've seen big underdogs win here recently, so it's not totally, you know, out of the woods that you pick Nate Landwehr. I think he's a great fighter. I love watching his fights. Again, M1 Challenge 95, you get the chance over on Fight TV. You can watch that one. You can watch them both fight on that card. He is a really fun fighter, and there's definitely opportunities here. If he can keep a good pace and keep good volume and really stifle everything that Evloev brings in, maybe Nate Landwehr gets a win. I just really like Mavsar Evloev. I mean, I was really high on him going into the fight against Mike Grundy. I love that traditional Greco-Roman style that he has, but his striking is very good. It's very refined. He'll throw a lot of spinning stuff, as they say. So overall, I like Mavsar Evloev, and I actually really like him a lot in this fight. So I'm looking forward to both going with Mavsar Evloev, but a much more competitive fight than those odds suggest. And maybe Nate Landwehr comes out of here with a win. I don't know. It should be a good one. It should be a great card. We're really looking forward to it. This is, of course, one of our Fight of the Night contenders between this and Benitez and Jane. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. We got a great card coming up. I mean, hey, Jack Hermanson taking on a really tough out Marvin Vettori in the main event. And as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Listen, I've been critical of the UFC's light heavyweight division in the past. Hey, when we get into MMA, it was the best division. We get into it for the Shoguns, the Machidas, the late Chuck Liddell pit of his career, and the Rampage Jacksons. And at the time, it was awesome. Right now, a little stagnant. But we have two fighters that are making it exciting. We have Georgia's Roman Delice taking on Brazil's John Allen. No relation. The last name is spelled differently than ours. But overall, this should be a great fight, Matt. We were so hyped about Roman Delice before he made his UFC debut. He was on an absolute tear, and then he had a lot of time off, a little bit of USADA complications, some fights that fell through, maybe some injuries, but Roman Delice definitely delivered in his debut, taking on former M1 Global Champ and UFC whipping boy, Hadis Ibrahimov. And overall, Roman Delice definitely delivered in that one, finished poor Hadis Ibrahimov in the first round, wanted some more, now he gets it. And Brazil's John Allen, really weird case because he lost on Contender Series, had a fight outside of the UFC, got a win. They bring him into the UFC and he fights Slow Mike Rodriguez. And Matt, for what it's worth, Slow Mike's all right. I mean, he's in the UFC. I'll never be there, but he's not bad.
I'd say we're higher on him than most people, honestly.
I really think so. You know what? That's true. John Allen beat him.
He did.
Won by decision. That was overturned to a no contest. So that's the no contest that's on his record. But he has a UFC win. Now, it's not the same type of no contest as Jamal Hill's no contest up at the top of the card. But overall, John Allen has a performance in the UFC that went well compared to his Dana White's Contender Series performance. He's a guy coming out of shoot the box in Brazil, Muay Thai artist, nice high stance. He's not known as a wrestler, which is kind of weird because if you watch his fight against Mike Rodriguez, he looked like a wrestler. John Allen's takedown defense, little bit shoddy. You worry about it a little bit. How's he going to be off his back? He definitely holds a lot of power in his hands. For Roman Delice, ADCC Oceania medalist, FILA World Grappling Champion. This guy hits like a Mack truck. And oh, by the way, this was in my notes, Matt. So he's a guy that's trained in Ukraine with pro kickboxer for a really long time. We know that he's a grappler, but his striking is good. And he's one of those grapplers that's really happy with his hands because he has a lot of power. But he can do a lot of things that grapplers don't. He keeps his hands a little low. He's got a decent chin. We've seen him crack, but he does have a decent chin. He's been training at Extreme Couture. And it's not like, well, he's been there for a week. He's been there for a little bit, training with Misha Serkinov, Nate Marcourt, the other name I have on here, Francis Ngannou, and Tyrone Spong.
He's pretty good.
He's pretty good, and I wanted to throw that out there because Roman Delice is training with these absolute killers in the higher weight classes, and it's great for his career. For John Allen, again, shoot the box Diego Lima, not Lima brother Diego Lima, but shoot the box Diego Lima. You're definitely going to get the right kind of training. Stylistically, this makes for a great fight. Oh, yeah. Allen off the Rodriguez performance, Delice coming off the Ibrahimov finish. I love this fight. I'm so excited. I've taken 3 minutes of your time. Matt, what do you think about this
one? I really am excited for this fight. And I do think the wrestling of John Allen's going to be a weird X factor in this. And I really only say that because we saw a lot of his wrestling offensively against Mike Rodriguez. We kind of have to throw all that out in this fight. If John Allen goes for a takedown on Roman Delice, that would be the worst idea he could possibly have. Just because the grappling difference between these two guys is quite extreme. And for Roman, You had said it. He does carry his hands very low, but it's sort of in like a Fedor Emelianenko pride way, where he does carry his hands low. They're kind of out a little bit, but he uses like weird lateral movement from side to side. So it does sort of work to his advantage. And I don't always see that as a negative, but again, something you have to bring up, especially against a technical guy like John Allen. If Roman Delice is just going out there throwing the wild hooks, I do get a little bit concerned, and especially if Delice has confidence early, if he is able to hit John Allen early on in the fight, I'm a little worried that he could start to get wild with some of those overhand shots. And against a guy like Allen, who can just put one or two down the middle pretty quick, Roman could run into a big shot and it could put him down. That's my one big concern for him in this fight. If he is crashing forward in that reckless manner, which we know that he does do, John Allen could have an elbow waiting for him. We see Darren Till do that a lot. He did that against Robert Whittaker, where if he waits and waits and waits and waits and waits and you crash in, it's not that he's meeting you with a shot. He just forces you to run into one. I could see that being sort of a game plan for John Allen. A
couple of weird things. I mean, if Roman Delice definitely didn't take on the best level of regional talent coming up through. But if you want to watch two really good fights, the last two, and again, 2 years, 5 months ago, he took on Eder D'Souza, knocked him out, and that was great. The fight that he had against Mikal Pasternak, no relation to David Pasternak, the Boston Bruins, about 2 years ago, was insane. You want to have fun? Go back and watch that with WWFC. He throws a low kick into a spinning back fist and knocks him out. It's absolutely insane, especially when you couple that with the fact that he's a primary grappler, but he doesn't really use it in MMA. I worry about that a little bit, especially in this fight. The other thing for John Allen, more so known as a striker with not great wrestling, or has throughout his career, he got outstruck in his last fight against Slow Mike, which is, you know, what it is. And he out-wrestled Slow Mike. He landed 4-6 total takedowns. An absolute shocker to me. Now, was that game planning on John Allen's part? Well, most likely, I would think it was. I worry about that, though, in this fight. Again, if he's working takedowns against such an experienced grappler in Delice, that's a problem. If you're going to strike with him, so be it. Delice, I wouldn't say he's hittable, but you can definitely hit him.
So I agree with that assessment a little bit. I think Roman Delice is going to win this fight. I'll give my prediction a little early. But again, when we talk about these guys starting to fight some of the upper echelon guys in the division, and 205 is very shallow at this point, but you have to think, Roman Delice eventually is going to have to fight, I'm going to say Anthony Smith is probably the worst of the elite at 205. Do you really like his chances against Anthony Smith right now? Not exactly. I do think he is going to have to make some little tweaks to his style, and he might need a loss for him to really do that. I don't see this being the fight that is going to set him down a different path, where maybe he does decide, okay, going for a takedown a little bit more often wouldn't be the worst idea. Maybe we don't get into some of these brawls. I think he's a guy who is going to need to learn on the job a little bit more as he goes forward, and at 32 is a little concerning, but I still do like him in this fight.
I do too, Matt. And I mean, if we have a look at the odds, Roman Delice opened a minus 200 favorite. He's now at a minus 170. For John Allen, opened up a plus 170. He's now at a plus 140. Over on Tapology, Matt, I would say a limited sample size. We're at 715 total votes now. 95% going Delice, 81% going with Delice by knockout. I think Delice is going to get the win. I think he's probably going to get the win by finish. I'm just sitting here scratching my head. Is he going to submit him or is he going to knock him out? I'd be more inclined to think submission, but that's just me.
It's a good problem to have when you can get it both ways. I think Delice, I'll just say the win. I won't put any cap on it saying he's going to get the finish, but I do really like him in this fight. And I'm excited to see him sort of fight some of those upper echelon guys as he moves forward.
Matt, really looking forward to this fight. We're both going with George's Roman Delice to get the win. It's a really interesting card. There's a lot of fights that might be flying under the radar, but one that isn't, our main event between Jack Hermanson and Marvin Vettori. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of movers and shakers at women's flyweight as we have Montana De La Rosa taking on Brazil's Taila Santos. Matt, I have to say this right here. All respect given to Taila Santos, because Matt, I've gotten away from locks of the night due in part to Taila Santos beating Molly McCann. I apologize to you, Miss Taila Santos. Overall, this fight, incredibly interesting. For Montana De La Rosa, somebody that fans have come to know and love and really appreciate. I know in her last five fights, 3-2 so far, those losses owed a good competition, Andrea Lee being one. And then in her last fight against a really tough out in Viviane Araújo, future champ at 125. Big Araújo guy. Now, overall, Montana De La Rosa, really known for her ground game, her wrestling, all-American wrestler. She's got a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Training for this fight, actually out of her native Texas, working with Lauren Murphy, mover and shaker at 125 at an advanced age for the division. But overall, Montana De La Rosa, she's won some good fights. She's lost a few good fights. And I mean, she's really hanging around in this division. For Taila Santos, 16-1, and you look at the body of work that she did on the regional scene, wasn't against the best level of competition. Comes in and gets a really good win on Dana White's Contender Series, and we have to talk about it over Estefany Almeida. Gets the win there by decision, unanimous 30-27 with all the judges. Tyla Santos, great with her hands, good takedown defense, and she's more than adept on the ground too. Very well-rounded fighter. Then she loses a split decision to Mauro Romero Barella, which is a head-scratcher, and if you want to play the MMA math game, the last win that Montana De La Rosa has, Mauro Romero Barella, no longer in the UFC. So Tyla Santos comes in as a pretty sizable underdog against Molly McCann. The Allen boys look like donks because we both said that Molly McCann's going to win that fight outright.
We look like donks quite a bit, Craig.
And Tyla Santos comes out and puts on an absolute masterclass. Her striking was on point. Molly McCann's right eye was just about swallowed shut after that one. Her takedown defense held up. She looked amazing in that fight. And it looked like for Tyla Santos, it was almost like, and this is a stretch, when Cynthia Calvillo came in and fought Jessica in a main event, you were like, wow, Cynthia Calvillo's ceiling at 125? Holy smokes, let me tell you. When Tyla Santos beat Molly McCann, the world went, wow, her ceiling's incredibly high. Now she's fighting Montana De La Rosa. It's not a weird matchup, but it's kind of a crossroads fight for both of these fighters.
It's a hard one to break down, I'm not going to lie. And it really comes down to, where do you put not only the ceiling, but the skill set of Tyla Santos this day? Because when you go to the Mauro Romero Barella fight, I finally said that right once, that never happens. She didn't look great in that. She got taken down, and she just seemed reactive to a lot of what Romero Barella was doing. It wasn't her leading the dance. Whereas in the Molly McCann fight, not only was her striking really good, we saw what her wrestling offense was like, and she had really good takedowns of her own. Now, does that come down to, well, Molly McCann's takedown defense isn't phenomenal. She's not really known as a grappler, much more of a boxer. Or is Tyla Santos really starting to make those improvements in her ground game? And Montana De La Rosa, excuse me, is a really good test for your grappling. Because what does she do well? She has very good offensive wrestling. She has really good top control. Good submission game as well. Good control on top. Her striking leaves a lot to be desired, though. And I always go back to the Andrea Lee fight. Andrea Lee fought her like Caitlin Chookagian fights everyone. The only difference was Andrea Lee would actually hit with quite a bit of power, and then she would move. And she'd actually start to land quite a bit of combinations. And Montana De La Rosa, not that she's like Paul Craig in this respect, but you can definitely tell that there comes a certain point in fights when she is fighting a striker and she's starting to get beat where she goes for a lot of panic takedowns. And that is my biggest pet peeve in all of MMA. When Nate Diaz famously said, "Oh, Conor McGregor, you're a wrestler now." When people do go for those panic shots, you're never going to get them, A, unless your name's like Derek Lewis, or unless your name's Daniel Cormier against Derek Lewis. It's not the best use of your energy. And that's one of those clear signs that, oh, this person's probably going to lose this fight. Because they do go for a lot of those sloppy single legs and just kind of lunging for a leg. I don't know if that's going to happen in this fight, but that's always something you do have to watch out for with Montana De La Rosa. If she is able to get the takedowns, that's when this fight becomes interesting. Because I do think Montana De La Rosa is the better wrestler out of these two. I don't think Santos is going to be
I don't think anybody's going to counter you there.
Exactly. I don't think Santos is going to use her wrestling like she did in the Molly McCann fight. I do think this fight's going to take place on the feet for the majority of it. And it really comes down to, can Tyla Santos damage Montana De La Rosa enough to where she can't get the takedown? To where every time she's shooting for a leg, she's getting beat up. And Santos has the skills to do that, but she can also be taken down. So it is a big crossroads fight. It's a bit of a seesaw fight because it's either going to be a lot of Montana De La Rosa getting the takedowns, getting the ground and pound, really sucking the fight out of Tyla Santos, or it's going to be Santos defending those takedowns, really going to the body of Montana De La Rosa and hurting her cardio. So this is going to be a fight of two stories. I just don't really know which side it's going to go.
And Matt, you really reference that Andrea Lee fight a lot, but the Montana De La Rosa fight against Viviane Araújo, and I know I've got the scorecards in front of me, 30-27. 30-27, 29-28. You could call the first round a 10-9 maybe for Montana De La Rosa. She did get a takedown. She got outstruck by Araújo. The strikes were a lot closer in the second round, but then that's when De La Rosa's starting to get outstruck a little bit. She's searching for a takedown, misses one there. And then in the third round, she goes for three takedowns, isn't able to land any of them. She outstrikes Viviane Araújo, not for as good of a percentage. And if you looked at their faces at the end of the fight, well, if you're just judging it off of that, who won? Viviane Araújo, for sure. Montana De La Rosa did not look all that great after that fight. She definitely got outstruck. And as far as the angles were concerned, that's what I like about Viviane Araújo. Really good head movement, really good top movement. She can really land combinations well. For Montana De La Rosa, more square angles than anything, and that's where she can really get exposed against that high-level striker. Can Ty Los Santos do that in this fight? Well, we're going to find out on Saturday. As far as the odds are concerned in this one, Matt, Ty Los Santos actually opened as a really big favorite. Minus 265, that line shrunk. She's now minus 208 average on best fight odds. For Montana De La Rosa, open a plus 185. She's now a plus 170 underdog. Over on Tapology, it's pretty cut and dry with the fans. Out of 671 total votes, 84% going with Ty Los Santos, 86% with her to win by decision. It is an interesting fight, and it is more or less a clash of styles, I'd like to say, because again, I agree with you. Montana De La Rosa is a really good wrestler, and she's a pretty good grappler too, and it's just bringing everything together. Exactly. That win over Mara Romero Barella, a weird fight. There were points in that fight where Mara Romero Barella, you're sitting there screaming at your TV the fact that she could have gone for a choke. She could have gone for a twister at one point, and the broadcast was saying it, but again, didn't really realize it. And again, it's Mara Romero Barella, no longer in the UFC, but still, there were some sketchy points in that fight. I don't expect Ty Los Santos to even want to take the fight to the ground. I expect her to want to strike in this one for sure.
I don't think you can ever fault a fighter for not finishing a twister. There's only ever been two of them in UFC history, so I would look into that a lot. Where the odds are doesn't make any sense. Now, I do think Montana De La Rosa is going to win this fight, regardless of the odds. I do think it's a decent underdog pick. I like her wrestling, and I do wonder a little bit about the wrestling defense of Ty Los Santos, especially if Mara Romero Barella was able to take her down multiple times. It comes down to, and again, we've been over this, if Santos can defend those first couple takedowns and really force De La Rosa to be uncomfortable on her feet, because that's what it comes down to. Montana De La Rosa as a striker, I wouldn't even say she is average. I do think that there are some serious holes in her stand-up, but I don't know if this is the fight or if Santos is the type of opponent that can really take advantage of those. We've seen Araujo was able to do that, but she's a very high-level striker. Andrea Lee was able to do that, but again, her striking is quite high-level. So when Montana De La Rosa fights those type of fighters, she is going to come into some trouble. I'm just not sure if I'm ready to label Ty Los Santos as one of those fighters just yet. This could be one of those fights where I'm completely wrong. Santos goes out there, and I think really high of her moving forward, but it's just really hard to say that right now, at this moment, she could beat a fighter like Montana De La Rosa.
Matt, I had to go back and watch the regional fights of Ty Los Santos. I definitely like what I saw. And as far as that Mara Romero Barella fight, she was able to defend the late takedown attempts from Mara Romero. So if you can kind of work off of that, well, I mean, that's similar to the game plan that Montana De La Rosa normally goes with. And again, Ty Los Santos lost that fight. For what it's worth, it was a split decision too. So there is that. But overall, really like the striking of Ty Los Santos. If the takedown defense holds up, if she can keep her back and keep posted up against the fence, I think she has a great shot. She could be a 125er Jermaine Duranemi. Wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't that be great? She's not the same level striker, but hey, who knows? Overall, I like this fight. I'm going with Ty Los Santos in this one. Yeah. She won me over with the performance over Molly McCann. If you can beat a fighter like McCann with the boxing, if you can work your takedown defense just a little bit more as you go on, Ty Los Santos could be a force. I know odds makers agree with that, and I know the fans do as well. So I'm going to go with Ty Los Santos here. You're going to disagree with me.
Again, I can't disagree with anything you said, but again, her best win is Molly McCann. And could Montana De La Rosa take down Molly McCann five times and beat her that way? Well, that would probably be her game plan. So it's just really hard to gauge where Ty Los Santos is in her career. Again, if she beats Montana De La Rosa, then I'm on the train. I'm just not there yet, so I still got De La Rosa.
Matt, I'm really looking forward to this one. It should be a good fight. You're going with Montana De La Rosa. I'm going with Ty Los Santos, and it is a very interesting card. A lot of under-the-radar fights, especially on the prelims, so make sure you check those out in the playlist. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really looking forward to our co-main event this weekend between Ovince St. Preux, former title challenger, UFC 197 against John Jones, fighting with a broken arm. The guy is an absolute legend at light heavyweight, and we should give him the respect he deserves. I know we've renamed Choke from Von Flew to Von Preux. The guy can get it done in all sorts of different methods, and he's basically taking on, and this is a stretch, a younger version of himself. When I see Jamahal Hill in that cage from that long southpaw stance, whipping those left kicks at guys' bodies, at their legs, wherever, it's like watching an old Ovince St. Preux. They do a lot of the same things. Jamahal Hill, I don't know where his ground game's at these days, but I can tell you that Ovince St. Preux is one of the sneakiest fighters once he gets onto the ground. Just ask Tyson Pedro with that straight arm lock that Ovince St. Preux kind of weaseled his way into. And that's the thing. Ovince St. Preux is such a weird, sneaky fighter. He gets cracked and you think he's totally knocked out, and then the next minute he's choking you out. He's doing something crazy. Just ask Yushin Okami. Overall, again, Ovince St. Preux, tons of experience in the cage, former Strikeforce vet. He's been with UFC for the longest time. He's fought for a belt in the past. Jamal Hill, this is only his third UFC fight, coming in off Contender Series, had a huge win over Darko Stuzic in his debut, and then he took on my guy, Clidson Fajes de Abreu, and he won the fight, and he finished him in the first round. That fight, it's a win on some sites. I have it as a win. I have him as 8-0. You might see on the UFC broadcast, he's 7-0 because that fight was supposed to be overturned to a no contest because Jamal Hill tested positive for, as Stephen A. Smith would say, Matt, the weed.
It's a dumb rule, but it is a rule.
It's a rule. So Jamal Hill lost his win because of the weed. Now he's taking on Ovince St. Preux. And really, he didn't lose any standing in the UFC. He still gained off a win like that.
100%. And this is a really fun fight. And I do need to give you credit. Craig's been calling for these two guys to fight for a minute now, because the comparison is quite easy to make between Jamal Hill and Ovince St. Preux. When you watch a lot of MMA, Jamal Hill does have that kind of upright stance like OSP. I have a bit of an X factor in this fight. Ovince St. Preux is terrible at fighting southpaws, and I don't just mean bad at it. He gets hit with left straights like it's going out of style, and there are a bunch of different examples you can draw from. Dominic Reyes didn't actually get the knockout win, but a lot of people will remember Dominic Reyes probably should have knocked out OSP in their fight, because in the last second, cracks him with left straight, puts him down. Tyson Pedro, the exact same punch. And if guys like that are able to have success, now, I'm not putting Jamal Hill in that Dominic Reyes area, because of course, Dominic Reyes, we all know how good he is now. Jamal Hill is more than capable of landing those very similar strikes. And with the Tyson Pedro fight, I do think that's an important one to bring up, because OSP's been in this position a few times where he's fighting top 15 guys and he's not really getting it done against like the top 10 in the division anymore. But the second they give him an unranked guy, he just runs over them like it's nothing. And we've seen this a few times now. The Michael Oleksiychuk fight is one that's always going to stand out in my mind, because I was like, oh, Oleksiychuk's going to murder OSP. And he just immediately gets him into the St. Preux choke. So OSP has that weird, like, Jar Jar Binks style about him, to where he'll just kind of stumble into wins sometimes. And it is really fun to watch as a fan, because you know when you watch OSP fight, something weird's about to happen. And it's not always a positive thing. Sometimes it can be negative.
Yeah, you gotta pump the brakes a little bit, because something weird could end up like his fight with Ben Rothwell, but continue.
Exactly. Now, in the Ben Rothwell fight, that was an interesting one, because OSP'd. He put his back against the cage. He had a very low output. But every time he hit Ben Rothwell, and Ben Rothwell is a big heavyweight with a very good chin, every time he'd crack him, he would put him down. And it was really frustrating, because OSP, you could tell he had the power advantage, he had the technique advantage, he just didn't throw the volume along with it. He would hurt Ben Rothwell, he'd stumble him, he'd drop him, and then Ben Rothwell would just kind of move his way back into the fight, and just through throwing volume was able to win rounds. Jamal Hill will play the OSP game with OSP, he'll throw the single shots with him. It's just with Jamal Hill, I know what shots I'm going to get, and I know what stage of his career he is at. He is the prospect on his way up, and I know OSP's been in this position before, and he's a great deterrent, if you will, for those prospects. I don't know if this is the fight. I do like the kicks of Jamal Hill. I like the inside leg kick that's going to be open on OSP, but even me saying all this stuff and all these complimentary things towards Jamal Hill, OSP can knock out anyone at any moment of any fight, even when he's lost, you know, 2 rounds and 4 minutes and 50 seconds. Like, the Corey Anderson fight's a great example, too. When he throws, he hurts Corey Anderson. He puts him down, he drops him. And then Corey Anderson works his way back into the fight. And then the fight, of course, ends with a super vicious head kick KO from OSP. So, it just, OSP on his best day looks like he could challenge Jan Blachowicz for the title. And OSP on his worst day looks like he could barely win on the Bellator prelims. So, it's just so hard to gauge where he is going to be at this stage in his career.
It is difficult. I mean, if you look at OSP's last fight against Alonzo Menafield, it was one of those cat and mouse, wait, time it, boom, you finish Alonzo Menafield. It was a great win for OSP. Before that, again, the Ben Rothwell fight. And if you look at his overall body of work, he's alternated wins and losses recently. Before that, 2 losses. To Nikita Krylov, he gets submitted, and then the loss to Dominic Reyes, where he got out-volumed, which is a problem against a guy like Jamal Hill, who will play the volume game. The one thing that I worry about with Jamal Hill, Darko Stuzic was able to take him down time and time and time again. Now, did Jamal Hill pop back up and win that fight and ultimately see you later, Darko Stuzic from the UFC? He did. Overall, giving the numbers, Stuzic went 6-9 in terms of total takedowns. Ovince St. Preux isn't known as this crazy offensive wrestler. Ow. Most of the time, he'll crack you, he'll take you down, or it ends up from some sort of clinch position. And Ovince St. Preux isn't known as a guy that pushes a crazy pace either. He'll wait and bait and then try and counter you. He does a lot of neat things. He's a neat fighter to watch. And, you know, inside baseball, I don't miss a lot of fights, but B, like, this is must-see TV for me when Ovince St. Preux is fighting, yeah, because something crazy could certainly happen. That's why they have this in the co-main event. Maybe you're going to hear the comparisons that these guys fight somewhat similarly. I just worry about that takedown defense of Jamal Hill. Now, I have to pay him a compliment. Training at a Murcielago MMA. And if you asked me about Murcielago MMA about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, I would have said, what? They go to Michigan? Like with Daquan Townsend? What are you talking about? But Joaquin Buckley and Chaos Williams really putting that gym on the map these days. Jamal Hill spending some time there training as well. So, hey, it can't hurt, especially coming off with some shine like those two definitely have. So, overall, really interesting fight. As far as those odds are concerned, Jamal Hill opened a minus 135 favorite. He is now a minus 168 over on Best Fight Odds. For OSP, he opened a plus 115. He's now at a plus 139. And the Tapology votes, people are split, Matt. Out of 715 total votes, 53% going Hill. His method of victory for those voters, 63% going with the win by knockout. For the voters that went with OSP, the remaining 47%, 53% saying he's going to win by submission. It's cut and dry, Matt, right? Like, it's one or the other.
It is. Okay, every now and then I have a good feeling about a fight, and I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to say it's a lock or anything. I have a good feeling about Jamal Hill in this fight solely because the techniques that he's great at throwing, OSP has proven in the past that he's not great at defending them. And the fact that Jamal Hill is a southpaw fighting another southpaw, it is weird because we always talk about how orthodox fighters have trouble with southpaw fighters. Southpaw fighters themselves have trouble with southpaw fighters. It's just not a look that you see all that often. So it will be interesting to see both guys kind of fighting something that they're used to having the advantage in. I do see Jamal Hill getting it done. I like his power shots down the middle. And with OSP, yes, he has the one-shot knockout potential. I can't take that away from him. And I'm not going to feel like an idiot if Jamal Hill's doing really well and OSP head kicks him in the third round. That's going to happen in an OSP fight every now and then. But the fact that Jamal Hill can stay disciplined if he wants to and not throw a crazy high volume if he is starting to land good power shots, or he can go into his more volume-oriented mode. I do worry about the ground game. OSP is going to have an advantage, especially with the submissions on the mat. But it's not like OSP is a very dangerous wrestler in his own right. He is a guy who's comfortable getting backed up to the cage, and he is starting to get into the Tyron Woodley level where, yes, he will let his hands throw when you do get him up against the cage, but OSP, that's just kind of his natural position at this point, where he gets behind those two black lines, he's not afraid to skirt around the cage, and against a guy like Jamal Hill, that's going to force you to react constantly, and I don't really like you reacting a lot against such a young and talented prospect like Hill.
I agree with you, and Matt, I'm a really big Jamal Hill guy, but I will differ in the pick, actually. I like Ovince St. Preux in this fight because he's fought fighters somewhat similar to Jamal Hill before. You did mention the fact that he does struggle against volume-heavy southpaws. Again, perfect example, Dominic Reyes. Was he the champion on that night he fought John Jones?
Maybe,
but after that, he certainly wasn't against Jan Błachowicz. But overall, he did beat Ovince St. Preux at that game. He was very busy, and that's the way that you really have to beat Ovince St. Preux. Keep it standing, keep it in the middle, and just try and volume strike with him because he's a guy that has a pretty monotone output, and we talk about that a lot with a lot of different fighters. If they stay on their bike, it's usually a good thing. But with Ovince St. Preux, it's kind of the Uriah Hall effect of, all right, come on, let's go. And then when Uriah Hall's on, it's a Bavon Lewis type of finish. When Ovince St. Preux's on, it's a finish like he had against Alonzo Menafield in his last fight. But I will point out the fact that the fight that he had before the weird Ben Rothwell one-off at heavyweight against Olaszczyk, a super prospect, I guess, if you will, out of Poland, another southpaw. So it all depends on what you get now. Jamal Hill isn't Olaszczyk, so I will say that. But in terms of facing a southpaw, it's a 50-50 type of thing. I do think it's a good litmus test. Again, we talked about that with different fighters on this card. The fact that you have Jordan Leavitt taking on Matt Wyman. Now, again, Matt Wyman's 37-2, but he's at a totally different point in his career than Ovince St. Preux is. St. Preux is still competitive with some good fighters in this division. It is a little early for Hall, or for Hill, rather, but at least we get to kind of test the waters. Is he ready for the deep end or not? I just worry about him against a guy like Ovince St. Preux. I worry about that ground game. Listen, the guys at Murcielago MMA have been knocking guys out flat for the last number of months. So Jamal Hill could certainly go in there and do that. High on Jamal Hill. I like those X factors that Ovince St. Preux brings into this. I like the counter striking. I like the, you know, basically we're Will Smith and Gemini Man standing across from each other. Maybe the older guy wins. And that X factor of having such a sneaky ground game, I do like Ovince St. Preux in this fight.
Yeah, and again, I can't really disagree with much of what Craig said. It's just the hitability of OSP is always something that's going to concern me. And with Jamal Hill, the straight shots down the middle as opposed to the big looping hooks of OSP. Yes, if OSP lands one of those big shots, you're going to go down. I don't care who you are. But the fact that Jamal Hill can just get from point A to point B so much faster, I like Jamal Hill. I'll even say my stoppage.
Matt, I'm going with the underdog here in Ovince St. Preux, the old man at this point in the game. You're taking Jamal Hill. Really looking forward to this card, and you're not going to want to miss our breakdown of the main event, new main event between Jack Hermanson, the Joker, taking on the Italian Dream, Marvin Vittori. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Matt, all thanks to the fans out there. Support for Fight Night Picks is now brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. And Matt, I couldn't be more excited about this. Honestly, awesome. I know we took a week off last week. Maybe you're away from the Fight Night Picks brand. We chugged along with Question Mark Kicks. We brought out some new content, and a new addition to the show has been Manscaped. And you probably saw it earlier with our Fight in the Night picks to start off the card. But I'm really excited to have Manscaped on board. And I mean, they make some great products. And listen, we've all been there. I have bought the generic trimmer that you buy from the big box store, brought it home, and I had a nose hair trimmer. And to be totally honest, I have a nose hair problem. I'll admit it here on the internet in front of thousands of people. I have nose hair issues. And I had one of those ones with the blades on the side. And you get it in there, it hurts. It's not fun to use. You're using that trimmer. It doesn't work very good in the shower. You can't see what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, you're trying to get in real high and tight, and you nick your nuts, and then it's a problem, and it looks really bad in the shower for the next person that has to hop in the shower. If you don't clean it up, it's just a mess. I have to tell you, though, that's why Manscaped, they redesigned the electric trimmer. Now, Matt, if you go with the perfect package combo, you got the Manscaped boxer briefs. It's great stuff. You get the Manscaped shirt that Matt has on. You get a great little carrying case. You need a nice toiletry bag. They got one. It's nice, and it's leather. But if you look inside, this is where it really gets neat. And they've redesigned that electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team has perfected the greatest ball hair trimmer ever created. I talked about it, but they just released the new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. Look at that light there, Matt. Ceramic. It's great. Their third generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents. And when I tell you this is premium, I do mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes so you can take a longer shave. The waterproof technology allows you to groom the shower like Craig Allen does. You know, another important part of my life, apparently. And one of the coolest features is that LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for a closer and more precise trimming. They've also upgraded to a 7,000 RPM motor with quiet stroke technology. And let's not forget about that charging stand. Listen, you have friends or relatives over on a Skype or Zoom call. You're leading them through your house. You're saying, hey, look at how clean my bathroom is. Wow! You hit them with the Manscaped, and they're going to respect you for that one. Overall, you can show off your trimmer loud and proud because it is an intelligently designed stand, convenient charging dock powered by USB. You got the USB charger at home. I know you do. And if you get the perfect package combo, it's going to come with that as well. And if you're listening to me speak right now, I want you to experience this firsthand for yourself. Let's get that bush and tush clean. Get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Make your testies your besties. Matt, I know we both got these packages. We tried them out because you're not going to talk about something that you haven't tried. No word of a lie. Best thing I have in my grooming arsenal. And again, I talked about the nose hair trimmer. Let's pull this bad boy out. If you get the perfect package combo, it comes with the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's a salve. It works very nice. It keeps you nice and I said high and tight, but it keeps you high and tight all day. But the Crop Reviver Ball Toner, spritz a little bit of that on. You're going to feel nice and cool for a little while. It works very good, keeps things nice and clean. And I talked about it, but the Weed Whacker, Matt, this nose hair trimmer, look it up. Go to manscaped.com. Use that promo code FNP so they know that we sent you. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. It's at manscaped.com. Promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. Finally time for our main event of the evening. Matt, on somewhat a short notice for the man on the right-hand side of our screen, is Marvin Vittori taking this fight as Kevin Holland is out of the fight, as Darren Till is out of the fight. So ultimately, Jack Hermanson's third opponent changed. Now, Kevin Holland out due to COVID. He's been shuffled around. He's going to be taking on Jacare Souza in December as well. So look out for that fight, and we'll keep you posted with that one. But overall, in this one, the Italian Dream is on an absolute heater. Nice three-fight win streak. And we're talking about big-name opponents. I mean, Cesar Fajea, no longer in the UFC, so it is what it is. Andrew Aldearte Sanchez, the guy's on his own little run right now, so there's that. And then the win that he had over Carl Roberson, which was a weird one because they had beef. They were originally supposed to fight at one point. Then it fell out. They yelled at a hotel lobby. They eventually got their day in the cage. Carl Roberson did a cool flip off the cage. And ultimately, Marvin Vettori submitted him. And Marvin Vettori, a very, very good wrestler. His striking's there. A well-rounded guy in this division, coming in ranked 13th so far at middleweight. For Jack Hermanson, it's weird because he's been at the top of the heap for what seems like a while. And it isn't that long ago where he's beating guys like Gerald Meerschaert. Hamzat Chimaev's calling. He beat David Branch, no longer in the UFC. He beat Jacare by decision. That was a big one. He ended up losing to Jared Cannonier. Sometimes you're going to get finished when you're the hometown guy in a main event and the crowd's really behind you. And then he beat Kelvin Gastelum in his last time by heel hook. Now, Matt, I saw you kind of motion to me for a second. That win over David Branch that I glossed over was amazing.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, you discredited that win a little bit, but at the time, David Branch was a ranked middleweight, and that was the coming out party for Jack Hermanson. He'd had one opportunity sort of similar earlier on in his career where he fought Thiago Santos when Santos was ranked 15th. Now, that just wasn't his night. He got finished in the last second of the first round at 4 minutes and 59 seconds, but that's going to happen. Thiago Santos is an absolute murderer on the feet, not really on the ground. Not here nor there. Marvin Vettori has a lot of the tools that you look for when you're looking for a guy who isn't ranked yet or kind of a prospect that you think could go far in the future. I've had my eye on Marvin Vettori for a while. I've really thought that he's a guy who can make noise in the top 15. I don't ever think he's going to be champ just because, you know, middleweight's so stacked. But he's a guy who's going to be around the top 15 for a very long time. And I do like that he's finally got his opportunity against a big-name opponent. He'd been calling for Chris Weidman for a while. There was a few key matchups that he was looking for and he wasn't able to get. I knew he was supposed to fight Jacare next weekend, but if that fight was 2 years ago, I'd probably be really, really excited about it. But Jacare has looked old, for lack of a better term, recently. So I really do like this fight for Vettori. And if he is able to get a win over Jack Hermanson, like, the sky is not only the limit. Like, you're only main eventing from this point out. This is my problem. Jack Hermanson on the mat, I'm not going to say he's the most... He's not the best grappler in the division. He's the most unique grappler in the division. He's not going to wow you with his takedowns. He's not going to wow you with some of the transitions he has on the ground. Some of his submissions, not some of, his submission game is absolutely insane. The Dan Hardy calls it the Joker team that he gets. It's like an arm out guillotine instead of the arm in one. That's how he finished David Branch. Not only did he finish David Branch and Gerald Meerschaert with that technique, he almost submitted Jacare with it. He had Jacare in probably the tightest submission Jacare's been in outside of a pure jiu-jitsu competition, and it really forced Jacare to work out of that. Now, again, we're giving points for submission attempts, but you have to understand who that attempt was against in Jacare Souza.
And you know what? To a very lesser and lower extent, remember the time Bryce Mitchell fought Charles Rosa? It was like, Bryce Mitchell, you're fighting a black belt in jiu-jitsu, such a pure guy in Charles Rosa. And look at the performance that Bryce Mitchell put on. And not, a lot of people still talk about that one. With Jack Hermanson, it's kind of like, well, you know, Kelvin Gastelum. And remember how he looked in that main event against Jared Cannonier. We have to give more shine to that performance that he had against Jacare. Now, you just went through and discounted Jacare to where he's at right now. But at that point in time, that was still the Jacare that we knew and loved. Now, he was a bit removed from his strike force days. He was a bit removed from, like, top tier, like 1-3 status, but that was still good Jacare. That's all I want to say. And the other thing with David Branch, he made him look like a fool.
He did.
David Branch is a good fighter on the ground, and he made him look bad. Now, the Gastelum fight's weird. It was just a weird one. I remember watching it going, Kelvin Gastelum just doesn't look like prime, pumped up Gastelum. But overall, I don't want to discredit Jack Hermanson at all, because that heel hook and the way that he fished for it, it was over in an instant.
Exactly. And that's the thing you have to worry about Hermanson on the mat. You're always under threat of getting submitted. And I hate trying to oversimplify fights, but I do think this is one of the few that you can do it for. Can Marvin Vettori knock out Jack Hermanson? I think he can, but I wouldn't really play the odds in that way. Marvin Vettori, he's a big guy. He's a very physical fighter, but he reminds me a little bit of Ian Heinisch before he went to Bangkok, to where he doesn't have the finishing potential in a lot of his shots. He throws big hooks, he throws big power punches, but when they land, it's not like he's a guy who's been striking for his whole life towards the most efficient manner. So he can land big shots in the feet, but he's not a knockout artist per se. It's been a while since he's had a really meaningful knockout. And on the mat, yes, Marvin Vettori is a very good grappler, and I would say he's honestly the better wrestler out of these two, even though I do like the wrestling of Jack Hermanson quite a bit. But once the fight hits the mat, if Marvin Vettori is the one going for a takedown, I'm going to get very concerned, because Jack Hermanson can grab that guillotine, He's really good too at sweeps. If he is the one on his back, he's great at then using your momentum to get on top. And that is the scariest place to be in an MMA fight with Jack Hermanson. If he's on top of you, his ground and pound is the thing that he was known for before he started to get a lot of those submission wins. The Talis Leites performance, I know Talis Leites at that point in his career wasn't, you know, the top 15 guy that he was a little bit earlier. But still, to finish him on the ground and to get mounted, or to mount him after breaking your rib, which is what Jack Hermanson did in the first round. So he breaks his rib, complains about it to his corner, and then comes out and finishes a multiple degree black belt on the ground. I can't say enough great things about the ground game of Jack Hermanson, and that's what this comes down to. Mervin Vettori can outgrapple the majority of other guys in the top 15 of this division. Craig and I just kind of looked through, and Mervin Vettori, he has a really good chance of beating a lot of guys who are ranked. It's just Jack Hermanson's sort of the outlier. You can't really take him down because he is the submission threat. If you stand with him on the feet, Mervin Vettori will have success. But look at what Jack Hermanson did to Jacare. His volume is absurd. He is able to keep such a high work rate that he is going to win rounds. And even if Mervin Vettori is landing clean shots, I don't think the 1 to 2 clean shots that Vettori is going to land is going to then outweigh the 15-20 volume strikes that Jack Hermanson is always going to be there for. The striking defense of Jack Hermanson is something that does worry me a little bit. He's got the Justin Gaethje problem where he'll just sort of cover up and he'll just kind of cover up. And he finds these different positions to where he just kind of feels safe in. That worries me a little bit because he doesn't return with power like Gaethje. Something we talk about a lot. Gaethje, when he does curl up, he's waiting and waiting and waiting. And the second you make a mistake, that's when he cracks you with a big bomb. Hermanson, it'll just be more, I'm going to wait, 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 and then hope that you just stop throwing, and then I can return to my own offense. And that's what cost him against Jared Cannonier. Cannonier was able to defend the early takedowns. You can tell Jack Hermanson's not the most comfortable on his feet, although I do think we can both agree his striking game has come a long way since he did first join the UFC. But if Hermanson can't get the takedown, he fights a little bit like Frankie Edgar, where he needs the takedown to open up his striking. So if Vettori can defend takedowns early and really make Jack Hermanson uncomfortable on the feet, I do see Vettori winning the earlier rounds. But again, the output of Jack Hermanson is just really hard to bet against.
So, Matt, it's really funny because the last time that Mervin Vettori got a win by knockout, it was on Venator FC 2. Now, people might be familiar with Venator because that's where Mayhem Miller missed weight by, what, like a truckload?
For Bruce Mark, Paul Harris got knocked out by Emil Mack.
And then there's that crazy you're the best around meme. But overall, on that card, Mervin Vettori was the co-main event against Jack Mason, finished him with a knee in the first round. Jack Hermanson also on the main card of that. What? He beat Macy Rosensky by decision. And now we're here, a main event in the UFC. One other weird X factor, it's unfortunate for Jack Hermanson because you're getting ready for Darren Till, who's going to give you a complete package, but mostly the striking that we know and love. Then you're getting ready for a really tough out in Kevin Holland that, again, does everything well. He's adept on the ground, but mostly a striker. Now you get Mervin Vettori. Again, a jack of all trades. He's very good at everything. He wouldn't be ranked if he wasn't, but mostly known for his wrestling. And if you bring in the UFC stats aspect, which I think you can because both fighters have enough UFC experience, exactly. Jack Hermanson, very good strike differential, decent accuracy at 48%. I do worry about the striking defense at 56%. Now, again, surface level numbers, don't read too far into them. But again, like you said, Jack Hermanson will play that waiting game. That's going to get you caught, especially with the cannoneers of the division and the heavy-handed Santos type of guys. Santos as well. For Mervin Vettori, good striking numbers as well. Better defense, close in accuracy at 43%. Again, a lot of similarities. As far as the takedown numbers are concerned, pretty close too. I mean, more accuracy from Mervin Vettori. His last fight out, he looked great. Baby K. Carl Roberson, though, is a kickboxer.
Not great at ground.
That flip off the cage, again, can't get it out of my mind. It was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I'll talk about it forever. It was a great submission win from Mervin Vettori, but again, Carl Roberson, he was a featured prelim on a big pay-per-view card against Cesar Fajeda. I find that weird too from Carl Roberson, but that's neither here nor there. As far as this fight's concerned, Matt, and we look at the odds, Jack Hermanson opened a plus 140 favorite. He's now plus 111 over on best fight odds. For Mervin Vettori, opened a minus 160. He's now at a minus 135. If we look over at Tapology, 610 total votes, 72% have Hermanson, 58% of that 72 have him to win by submission. For those that voted with Vettori, 28%, 49% picking him to win a decision. Listen, there's definitely more than an opportunity for Mervin Vettori. I'm going off here a little bit.
There's
a good opportunity for Mervin Vettori. He was getting ready for a 3-round fight against Jacare, old man Jacare. That's a different fight than a 5-round fight with Jack Hermanson. Now, on average for Jack Hermanson in the UFC, 7 minutes and 28 seconds in the cage. So you're finishing or you're getting finished. And that's pretty well the way it's going to go. For Marvin Vettori, 12 minutes and 21 seconds. There's finishes. There's also decisions. But it's a 25-minute fight, and Jack Hermanson's been getting ready for guys in a 25-minute fight in a main event slot. Now, the opponents have changed. Jack Hermanson's fought wrestlers before. Marvin Vettori has fought grapplers before. It's a mixed bag. I mean, go back to the Omari Akhmedov fight. Akhmedov's a good wrestler. That ended a draw. There's a lot of things that are worrisome for me in this one if you're of the camp of Marvin Vettori.
So the real thing that concerns me for Vettori, and you kind of alluded to it, I'm not as worried as much about the fact that he only was training for a three-round fight. I'm worried about his cardio even in the three-round fight. We do see him tend to tire when he does have an elevated work rate. The Omari Akhmedov fight is a good example of that because the wrestling sort of canceled each other out and both guys were exhausted by the end of it. And Akhmedov was just sort of able to keep more of a labored pace than Vettori was. In this fight, if Vettori starts out well, he can win a couple rounds and then I think it's going to start going downhill. If Jack Hermanson gets off to a good start, then it's just downhill quick for Marvin Vettori. I like the ground and pound of Jack Hermanson. I love the ground game of Jack Hermanson. And I don't think Marvin Vettori is the type of guy who, again, we bring it up a lot. Uriah Hall is fine with getting his ass kicked for a very long time just to knock you out near the end of a fight. Marvin Vettori doesn't have that level of striking. Like, Marvin Vettori could probably beat Uriah Hall just based on styles. But if Uriah Hall fought Jack Hermanson, it's kind of the perfect it's the perfect opponent for him because he can wait. And since your striking defense isn't all that great, the second a big thing opens up, then crack, I can put you down. Vettori doesn't have that kind of power. He's a big guy for the division. He has good striking, but he's not the most technical guy to where he can pick apart the holes in your defense.
I gotta say, one thing for Marvin Vettori, credit where credit's due. If you're training at King's MMA, you're gonna pick some of those things up, especially by diffusion. I mean, you get a guy like Khalil Roundtree that spent a little bit of time getting Bangkok ready. That can't hurt either.
Oh, no. And, like, look at Bilal Dariush. He was primarily a grappler. Now he just knocks everyone out in crazy ways. So maybe we see a spinning back fist KO by Marvin Vettori. Highly unlikely. But Jack Hermanson's going to have this one done. I like the ground and pound. I like that a lot. I just see him winning by stoppage, probably in the third or fourth round due to ground and pound. I do see the pace getting to Marvin Vettori as the fight goes on. I think he'll be able to defend takedowns early. But again, as the fight goes on, I know what I'm going to get from Jack Hermanson. Not only can he have an elevated work rate for five rounds, because I've seen it before against Jacare, he didn't actually set the middleweight record at the time for significant strikes, landed in a fight in that. And that was against Jacare Souza. So I think I'll be able to outwork Vettori. I think Vettori will have his moments in this fight. And I think Vittori's going to be in the top 15 of the middleweight division for a very, very long time. I just think stylistically, Jack Hermanson's got his number.
Again, it's one of those fights where I look at Jack Hermanson and he's the type of guy, if he was Tim the Toolman Taylor going, he's really going into this fight going, because he has his whole tool belt and he can use everything that's there. For Marvin Vettori, he's one of those guys that's going to be around for a long time. And he is that type of jack-of-all-trades guy. It's just those tools are a little bit sharper with Jack Hermanson at this point. Now, again, he's had 3 extra years in MMA. He has more fights in his pro career. And hey, look at us now from where we came from, Venator FC 2. Those are all the cultural references I have for this fight. But overall, I do like Jack Hermanson in this fight as well. If it goes to the mat, I favor Hermanson. If it's on the feet, it's a 50-50, but I do like what I have from Jack Hermanson. And in terms of wrestling, yeah, Vettori can have the edge, and that's great. But do you really want to shoot a takedown against Jack Hermanson? You saw what happened to Gaslam. You saw what happened to Branch. You saw what happened to Jacare, even though that fight didn't end in a finish. You see what can happen against a guy like Jack Hermanson. So Marvin Vittori's path to victory, I would think, keep on your bike the whole time, throw constant volume, and maybe try and keep it in the center of the octagon. But that's really tough.
Well, yeah, that's everyone's playing against Jack Hermanson. There's a reason he's ranked 3rd in the division right now, though, because even though you know his game plan, he's good enough to get around it. Again, Marvin Vettori's only path to victory. I don't say about voluming Jack Hermanson because that's borderline impossible, just because Hermanson is always throwing, which can be a detriment. I think you need to meet him with power. I do think you have to force him to stand in the pocket for a little bit too long. Let his combinations run one or two punches long and then crack him for the return. I just don't know if Marvin Vettori has that kind of power. Excuse me. Maybe he can put down Jack Hermanson. I just don't see him on that Thiago Santos or Jared Cannonier level of power. So yeah, I got Jack Hermanson in what might even be a clinic.
Matt, I'm really looking forward to this fight. We're both going with Jack Hermanson to get the win. It's a sneaky card. There's a lot of great fights here. I mean, we've got Benitez taking on Justin James, a possible fight of the night. Also, Mavzar Evle, my guy, taking on a really tough out in Nate Landwehr, both former M1 Global champs. So you're going to want to check that out. Check out the playlist over there. Help out the boys. Be sure to check out Manscaped. Use the promo code FNP20. Percent off your order with the promo code FNP and free shipping at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you. The boys will thank you. And we can't wait to get busy in MMA this week. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it.